could move that?
Yes. It's been distributed, so.
If Mr. Do you want Mr. Turner to walk through? It looks worse than it really is. So maybe he can explain it for you.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, it looks quite daunting because there's so many number changes, but what they reflect are two changes to the compensation adjustments, one for the Department of Corrections, where we correctly distributed the compensation between the institutions, community services, and the operational services. And then every time we changed one of those numbers, it rolled up to the correctional totals and then the bill total. And there's one other, and it doesn't change the general fund total at all. All it does is redistribute among the divisions. There's one other number change in here, and that's that was a mistake that I made when I was engrossing the bill after committee. It's a special revenue change under the fire marshal. It was $145,000 short, and then that had to roll up through the public safety totals and the bill totals as well. Then we have a couple technical amendments. On page 1.15, 1.16, it's the Youth Intervention Program. We deleted the sentence that says money is available until expended. Page 10 or page 1.7 on the amendment, 1.8, are concerned with a rider that we will be adding later in the bill. Mr. Backus will go into that. Line 1.35 corrects a section reference in the bill. Line 1.37 is the beginning of a fire marshal change. It's obsolete language that was put in last year when we created the fire safety account. It has to do with the general fund base appropriation for the fire marshal program. So it's just a statutory cleanup. And then section 2.13 is the domestic abuse in-service training, and I'll let Mr. Backus speak to that.
Mr. Chair, members, this piece is simply the updated language that passed the Judiciary Committee. It's Senator Bonoff's language. The original language in the bill on page 24 was basically a placeholder, and this is the new language. What it does is, the difference is, the old language required the post board to provide, to prepare learning objectives for pre-service and in-service training for peace officers related to domestic abuse. This changes that, and it makes it so that for in-service training, essentially the board has to monitor and set minimum standards for that training, and then the training courses have to comply with it. And again, this is simply the language that the Judiciary Committee passed.
Okay. Sir Higgins, anything else on the amendment?
That's it.
Okay, members have questions. Sir Neville.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Turner, could you explain on this amendment? Looks like it increases total spending of the bill by about $5 million. If you look at the amendment that relates to 1.22 on the main bill. On the amendment, it's line 1.7, 1.8. So it's going from 1.424 billion to 1.429. I was just wondering where that, what that extra roughly $5 million is for. Am I reading it right?
Oh, yes. Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, that was the supplemental, the governor's supplemental recommendation to increase the fire safety account in the that we passed in division, if you remember. He had $4.5 million, and he added an additional $5 million for a total of $9
million. So we just forgot to put that in, or what?
No, this is the. Actually, yes, I guess that's the case, yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Neville, remember that's a special revenue account. That's not general fund.
Okay.
Further questions on the A3 amendment? Would someone like to move the amendment? Senator Frederickson would move the A3 amendment. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The spreadsheet that's in your packet that's dated March 21st at 9:17 a.m. is the spreadsheet that we'll be working from, and it reflects the A3 amendment that you just adopted. We were given a target in our division of approximately $25 million less than the governor's amount for this division. That's a little deceiving because his one-time money was kind of spread throughout, and our one-time money was put in a separate bill. And then, as we talked about in the amendment, we had the addition of $5 million for the fire safety account in special revenue. So we were very skinny in some places in our bill, and you'll see that as we have gone through. In every agency program, you will see that we have adopted the forecasted base. And then you'll also notice that we have put a salary increase of 3.25% for each year of the biennium, and that is also reflected in our spreadsheets. Starting with the public safety division, you'll see that there were four decision items proposed by the governor.
Thanks.
And we... Well, I guess it's two, actually, when you get rid of the compensation. And we did not adopt either of those. If we had had some money, we could have, that would have been items that we would look at, but we were not able to fund those. In the BCA, the superintendent had two priority items. They were CRIMNET and the addition of 20 forensic scientists at the BCA lab. Our CRIMNET was one-time funds, and so we put that in the one-time bill, and then we funded the 20 forensic scientists that the governor recommended. That helps not just in statewide investigations, but also in all of our local investigations. The next box is the fire marshal, and we've talked about that a little. We've got the updated numbers there. Gambling and alcohol enforcement was the governor's recommendation. The Office of Justice Programs received their forecast base. They have been harmed by the fact that Congress hasn't been able to pass the budget yet. And so the federal funds that most of these programs rely on aren't there for them this year. We tried to cover some of those funds, and we're able to do so in some items, but probably not back to the amount that the federal government had given them in any case. We had talked about an increase in the funding for the crime victims reparations. We were not able to do that. We increased the state funding for the gang and drug task force at the governor's recommended level.
Working on it.
The governor had a loosely defined school safety center proposal. We did not adopt that recommendation. On line 51, the victim notification system is a system that's used to notify victims when there's been a change in status of the offender. That's an item that lost federal funding as well. We were able to get about half of the governor's recommendation on that. Line 52 was a bill that we heard in committee, and you will probably, well, everybody around the table here was here when we passed the racial profiling bill 7-8 years ago, something like that. And part of that bill was grants to local governments for cameras in the squad cars if they did the racial profiling study that was required in the bill. Those cameras are now obsolete. It's almost impossible to get the tapes to record them, and they are now obsolete technology as well. This line would give grants for updating those to digital cameras in the squad cars. The language in the bill that we'll talk about a little bit later, if they were an original recipient of the cameras, they can get the grants. If they did not participate when we originally passed the racial profiling bill and want to acquire these cameras now, we require a 25% local match. We in the original bill, the study was considered the local match, and so we thought it was appropriate again to do a local match for folks for the local units who are now wanting to get these cameras. Line 53 is grants for local units of government for overtime. We heard very compelling testimony about communities like Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, and frankly elsewhere throughout the entire state, that the law enforcement divisions in each government are really strapped for work that they have to do when a major crime appears, and of course, who budgets for major crimes. Brooklyn Center has had two awful murders that they have been working tirelessly on, and frankly, they're running out of money. So this would help do that. There is, in existing statute, a committee of the Public Safety Commissioner, the chiefs, the heads of the chiefs and sheriff's associations, and other folks who make the determination on who gets these grants based on high crime areas within their jurisdictions and their need to cover some of their costs. Line 54 is grants for a collection of organizations called YIPA, the Youth Intervention Program. And they do great work keeping kids out of trouble, and so we have a modest amount of money for them. Line 55 is aid to a program that works with families of victims of murder or suicide, and they do work that we thought was pretty unique, and we gave them a very modest amount of money as well. The next two items are crime victims grants for sexual assault and domestic violence. The next box is the 911 emergency management system. We call it ARMOR. You may know it by the 800 megahertz name. This funding is a fee. It is an increase on your telephone bills, both landlines and cell, of 10 cents a year, increasing for the next 3 years, so 10 cents, 20 cents, and 30 cents for the next 3 years, and this would build out the ARMOR system into the rural areas.
10 cents a year.
And that completes the Public Safety Division, and you'll see that our division is recommending $294,799,000 for the biennium. The next box is the post board, the police officers standards board, and we gave them a modest increase in addition to their compensation adjustment and their base. Included in that modest increase is a little funding for the item that was on the back of the A3 amendment. The private detective board. Silly me, I didn't even know we had one until I got on this division, and they got their forecasted base and the compensation adjustment. Human Rights Department got the forecast base, their compensation adjustment, and then they desperately need to come into the 21st century. They still do their case management on paper instead of on a computer, so this would upgrade upgrade their case management system. The next set of items are for the corrections department. And they had, the governor had recommended that they get a 4.25 salary increase. We did the 3.25 that we have done throughout our entire division.
Yes.
I'll draw your attention to line 104. In the last biennium, we funded some items in correction, but we didn't pay for the tails. So that is almost $4 million that we had to account for, and that's on line 104. Corrections also has an increase in health services and fuel and utility costs and retiree insurance costs, and those are reflected in the next three lines. Corrections has also started looking seriously about issues related to reentry into the community when somebody has served their sentence and now comes out into the community. So you'll see two or three items here in the spreadsheet related to reentry. The item on line 108 is for services in the corrections institutions to prepare folks before they actually leave. Line 109, we have Senator Neville to thank for this. This is a bill that he brought increasing the thresholds for theft and what gets you into misdemeanor, gross to misdemeanor, and felony. That actually saved us money, and I've thanked Senator Neville a million times for that and want to thank him again for that. The community services part of corrections starts in the box on line 116. We have on 119 the intensive supervised release agents for the boot camp at Willow River. They're expanding to be twice the size that they are now, and this is working with folks when they leave there. The next item is for the conditional release program, the intensive supervised release agents. We were we were not able to get to the governor's recommendation on that, but it's a really good program, and some way we'll figure something out maybe. Line 121, there were changes proposed to the Interstate Compact, and we were not able to fund that. Line 122 is a proposal from the department asking for a legal staff to help them make decisions related to civil commitment and the community notification. And we were able to get about half of the governor's recommendation on that. Line 123 is an increase to the Community Corrections Act counties. Line 124 is an increase for the county probation officers. We know that both of these are very underfunded, and we were able to do the governor's recommendation on both of those items, as well as the next item, 125, which is the DOC probation increase. The next several items are all related to sex offenders. The governor put a lot of money toward this. We were not able to get all of that money in there, and we're able to fund it at about $2,150,000 for the biennium. Line 132, sentence to serve. I think you all know what sentence to serve is. They lost federal funding, and we were able to get back about half of that. Line 133, for the last several years, we have been housing short-term offenders in the county jail systems. We are paying them, paying the counties less than $10 a day for housing those offenders. And we heard loud and clear from all the counties that it costs $50 to $60 to $70 a day to house those offenders. We were able to get an increase. The governor had an increase to $30 a day. We were able to get to about $33 a day, and that is reflected in line 133. Line 134 is the Corrections M Corp offender reentry services that we funded almost to the governor's recommendation. We're pretty close, actually, on that one. And oh, that's right. And we were recently notified that they got a federal grant for this as well. Line 135, we had a lot of proposals from nonprofit organizations, community organizations who want to help with the work with reentry out in the community when folks come back home. And rather than picking and choosing among all of those organizations, line 135 sets up an RFP grant proposal that the department would be able to pick some partners to help with that. And frankly, most of the proposals we got were from North Minneapolis, and I would hope that the department would be able to do some more geographic representation in that. Having said that, line 136 is a reentry grant for a new proposal in North Minneapolis, specifically getting jobs for the reoffenders. We know that that is one of the hardest things that they can do, and this is to help in that effort. Line 137 is a new program that will be a mentoring program for youth of incarcerated who have parents in the correctional system. The division went to visit Red Wing one day and turned out it was high school graduation day, and Senator Murphy gave the graduation speech, and as usual, he did a great job. What we found there was 67% of the kids who are in Red Wing have a parent also in the system. And we think that we can maybe keep some kids from getting into the system if they get a mentor while their parents are away. And that finishes the community services section. The top box on the page 4 is the central office funding for corrections. That ends the corrections appropriations. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission starts on line 157. And we have one new item there, and that is from Senator Moi. It is a study dealing with the issues related to the collateral consequences of criminal, basically, and then also dealing with looking at the sealing of records, the expungement issues. And that's a study that the Guidelines Commission will do. So, Mr. Chair, at the end of the day, we spent our target, $1,109,498,000. We have it before you for discussion.
Are there any questions? Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, in the corrections box, there's a line item I don't recall having seen before. It's called retiree insurance. You give an explanation of that, and I think that's unusual, but I'm say for sure.
Sorry, I didn't.
I suspect corrections is here and could probably tell you better than I could. I believe it's related to the fact that we pay the health care for the retirees for corrections officers because they can retire at an earlier age than the rest of ours. But Mr. Benson is here. I knew he would be here, and he'll be able to tell you.
Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members, and Senator Fredrickson. To your question, there never has been a
Commissioner,
line.
Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I'm Dennis Benson, a Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Historically, there has not been a line item for retiree insurance, and this is one of the drivers of, obviously, our salary budget because we have had to somehow find the money to pay retiree insurance for those correctional officers that do retire at somewhere around age 55. They're eligible, and on retirement, like police and highway patrol, they get their health insurance paid. with the number of employees that are retiring these days, it's simply not possible that the department find those dollars anymore, particularly when we have been underfunded for several bienniums now with respect to inflationary costs of salaries. There just simply aren't the funds. So last year we were underfunded, I think, close to $1 million, and we anticipate that number going up every year as the bulk of our correctional officers get ready to retire.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Benson, so paying retiree insurance is unique to corrections and law enforcement?
Yep. Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, that's my understanding. There may be some other small groups that get health insurance paid on retirement, but this is a negotiated benefit. It's in the correctional officer's early retirement plan. I know it's in the highway patrol plan, and we also have to believe some of our fugitive officers are also eligible for this benefit.
Thank you. Commissioner, if I can follow up on Senator Fredrickson's question, I'm not sure I disagree with your description of some of the funding problems. How would you distinguish your department from every other department agency and anything else we've been doing over the last number of years in terms of underfunding?
Mr. Chair and members, I think one of the unique features of our department is that we've doubled in size in the last 11 years. We have zero control over our growth. That is driven primarily by policy, and much of that policy, of course, emulates from the legislature. We have gone from about 4,500 offenders to 9,000 offenders in the 11 years that I've been the deputy commissioner. And those numbers result in having to fill 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week posts, which is also a unique feature to corrections. And obviously, if we don't fill those positions, we can create dangerous environments inside of our work settings, and I think that's also unique to corrections. The other feature that I think is unique is that we do have about, I believe it's around 2,000 uniformed employees that are eligible for this benefit of retiree insurance upon retirement. So those things are, I think, very unique to corrections. We don't have control of our growth. We've absorbed lots and lots of growth the last decade, and we have some benefits that are somewhat unique to our workforce.
Commissioner, I'm not sure I disagree. My only comment is that this is, to be honest, and this isn't to impugn what you've just offered to us at all, to the contrary, but we hear the same exposition from the Highway Patrol, from the major police departments in Minnesota. We hear it throughout law enforcement. We hear it from county corrections that the criminal justice system as a whole is underfunded. And obviously in this year's session, we're going to try to make some dents in some areas of the budget. It's going to be difficult to do what ought to be done in all areas of the budget. So I'm not sure I disagree, but what you've suggested is, you know, if we maybe do it apples to apples as opposed to compare Department of Corrections to, you know, Department of Revenue or to County Human Services, if we just do it law enforcement to law enforcement, what you've suggested is what we hear from law enforcement and criminal justice throughout the state. And again, that's not to criticize what you're suggesting at all. It just underscores the fact that with a growing population, with, as you suggest fairly, that the legislature and the governor have been responsible for policy changes imposed directly on your department. But with a larger population, Senator Higgins has talked about some of the growth in crime that you'll find in parts of the Twin Cities, whether it's a reflection of society, whether it's a reflection of legislative action or inaction, the reality is that the criminal justice system is growing, and you're not unique in that regard.
Mr. Chair, I certainly agree with you. I think that this is not only a state issue, but a local issue as well. I'd also say that despite all of that, I do think we've done a lot of things right in Minnesota. I think the fact that we still lock up fewer per capita than most states in the union is a good thing. We try to manage crime at the lowest possible level. We do save those expensive prison beds for those that need to be there. And our Community Corrections Act is a big part of our system, and they take a real load off of our system in that they're able to manage some of the lower-level offenders in the communities. And I think that saves the state lots of money as well. So I'm certainly not being critical of what's happened, but the reality is we all know what's happened with respect to crime and violence, not only in Minnesota but across America, and I think we've done the best we can to deal with it. But when you make that decision to cross the line and put somebody inside of a 8x10 cell, it gets very, very expensive. And I just, having worked out in those facilities for about 22 years, it's critically important to us that we're able to fill those posts and keep our system off the front page of the newspaper, unlike so many states in the union. I think we've got a good prison system. I think we have people like Senator Higgins and yourself and other legislative leaders who have taken an interest, take public safety very seriously, and have done the best you can to fund our agency over a time of unprecedented growth.
Thanks. Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, as long as Mr. Benson's up there. On the compensation adjustment, this bill budgets 3.25% a year, which is about $6 million under the governor's rec. And it's my understanding that what corrections was asking for four something a year. Tell me why you need more, and what would be the effect or the consequence if we funded 3.25%.
Mr. Chair, Senator Neville. Again, I think our agency is unique. If you recall, I believe it was last year, it goes into effect this year, but MSRS is trying to adjust the retirement funds for the Correctional Officer Early Retirement Fund. As we sit here today, it's underfunded. I think we got a flyer in the mail that says it's underfunded by about 17%. And trying to bring that level up to par requires more of a contribution, not only on the employees' part, but the state's part as well. That's one driver of inflation in the salary adjustment that sets our correctional officers apart from the rest of the agency. When we add the across-the-board adjustment, 2% and 2% each year, step increases, health insurance increases, and this is all predicted, but we've been pretty accurate in the past, or Department of Finance has, and Department of Finance actually feeds us those numbers. Our EBO and their staff came up with the 4.25, which I need to tell you, still doesn't get us quite to where we need to be in terms of those inflationary factors, but it gets us close enough that I think we can manage it. We fund our facilities at about 97 or 98% with turnover. That makes it manageable. $6 million is a stretch for us. That's this is going to be a pressure point for us as we move through the process and move toward conference committee. We're going to have to hold positions open is basically what the bottom line is with respect to that kind of a gap.
Treat me pretty well.
One more follow-up. I'm still not sure what's unique about corrections compared to other agencies.
Well, again,
why do you need that much more?
Mr. Chair, Senator Neville, the fees that we have to pay for retiree insurance, the state's contribution is higher for correctional officers to try to balance that.
So everybody has to pay, but your share is higher?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Benson, you know that quite a bit of what goes on in your budget and your institution affects my budget. And so the question that I have for you is, why are sex offenders released from prison on good time when they haven't successfully completed sex offender treatment.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we have a process whereby sex offenders are held accountable to a degree for not participating or not choosing to participate in treatment. We do extend their good time. In some cases, it's 60, 90, 120 days, I believe. We don't take them all the way to the expiration of their sentence. We would not be comfortable with that. If we were going to move in that direction, we would want to explore, I think, a statutory change. What we do, though, is we put those offenders, when they are released, on community supervision. We keep a close eye on them. We certainly, they are either level 1, 2, or 3 designation prior to release. They're on intensive community supervision. And in some cases, they are committed. So I think there's a sliding scale of accountability for sex offenders, but it gets difficult given the statutory requirements that at the end of your two-thirds time, you are entitled to release. And again, our due process system, I think we've been able to do some things. We do the same things for those that don't participate in chemical dependency treatment. If we have the bed and they're not willing, there's some accountability there too as well. But we try to balance that with public safety, with our beds, with our treatment beds. We have a long list of people who are very willing to participate, so there are always people that are willing to go into those beds.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Benson, I guess my concern primarily lies with the level 3 offenders that have not successfully completed treatment, who would then be referred for commitment, all of whom I believe are committed. And if you think crossing the line and putting somebody in a prison bed is expensive, you ought to try crossing the line and putting them in a commitment bed. It's about, well, 6 times as expensive. And so I'm just wondering, I understand it might take a statutory change, but I mean, it does seem to me that there would be some justification for not giving people good time if they have not successfully completed their treatment.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we have had lots of discussion with the Department of Human Services with respect to this issue. We've talked about different possibilities with respect to legally keeping those offenders in our system longer as opposed to moving them through the very expensive civil commitment process into a state hospital, particularly if they aren't willing to participate in treatment. So those options are being explored. We've worked very closely with Mike Tesner at DHS and their legal staff, our legal staff, but we didn't get this on the table in time for this session, but I think it's something that will continue to be explored as we move forward.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a closing comment. We need to explore this seriously because if we don't, as far as I can tell, we're on a trajectory to bond for a new facility for sex offenders every year. And we pay the operating costs for that out of my budget. And it's going to consume my budget so that we're not going to be able to pay for things that people want us to do in the community, like taking care of grandma in the nursing home and providing child care for people that need subsidies to get into the workforce, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, just one comment from me as well. I think you know that we have pushing 100 now sex offenders that are civilly committed that are residing in our Moose Lake facility. We've actually made space. We created an in internal perimeter where we're holding those offenders, and we're doing that, I think, much cheaper than the rate a mile away in a PP hospital. So I agree with you. I think that we have to continue to partnership and try to figure out a legal, safe way to manage these offenders as cheaply as we can, but at the same time aggressively pursuing the treatment options. It becomes very different, as you know, once they are no longer under sentence and they're civilly committed.
You know, Commissioner, relative to that, I was struck in, there were a series of articles a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times about the civil commitment process throughout the country, and it was interesting to note that Minnesota was the only state in the country that had a civil commitment process, I believe, where nobody had ever been released. And I thought that was interesting, and it's probably a subject for a different day, maybe more within the divisions than here in the full committee. But obviously when the governor issued his executive order, I think 3 years ago, when he and everybody else were scared by the Rodriguez situation, it seems to me someday there's going to be some federal judge who's going to step in and just rip the system apart when you look at where Minnesota is compared to other states. And you don't have to comment on that because that's I've never brought a Sir Neville, I don't know if you've ever brought a habeas corpus action in federal court. I sure haven't, so I'm not the attorney to do it. But it just seems to me that at some point there might be a different kind of explosion in the system. Other questions for Sir Neville?
Just to follow up on Senator Berglund's question, with respect to the level threes, the most dangerous ones, that when they get to the end of their time, is there any kind of a policy, explicit or implicit, that if they successfully complete sex offender treatment in prison, that they're less likely to be civilly committed? It's my understanding the county attorneys make those decisions, not you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, that's correct. We would still, if we believed that they needed to be referred for review, we would certainly do that.
What Mr. Chair and Mr. Benson, what percentage of level threes do you estimate are referred for civil commitment?
All of them.
All of them?
That's the policy.
Almost all, I guess I hear somebody saying.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, I'm not the expert in that area, but certainly they're all reviewed, and I don't know what percent, but I'm sure Deputy Commissioner Nelson can give you those numbers at either now or at some point.
It strikes me, Senator Berglund, in response, let's say it's all. That's a pretty good reason why people wouldn't want to participate in sex offender treatment in prison. Why should they? They're going to be civilly committed anyway.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Neville, they don't know if they're a level three at the time they're in prison. That determination is not made until shortly before they're released. My point is, if they haven't been willing to participate in treatment in prison, we are going to then commit them to an over $300 a day program to give them treatment that they're not going to be willing to participate in at that time either. And if we have, you know, the concept of good time is that you do certain things to earn your good time. It just has occurred to me that part of earning your good time, if you're a sex offender, might include at least being willing to participate in treatment while you're in prison.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't disagree, but we made this bed ourselves with the laws and the civil commitment laws that we passed. There were only a few of us who raised concerns when we passed that 10, 12 years ago, when we created our first sex offender treatment facility. It was, 50 or 100 beds, and we thought that would last us. And it's just mushroomed now. I mean, the place where these people should stay is in corrections. And we did try to start fixing that in 05. If we can somehow identify the worst sex offenders, we should stop using our civil commitment facilities just to confine people when perhaps they should be confined in longer term in the correctional facility. And there's a few of us who have done that for a number of years.
Senator Neville, have you raised that concern with the governor?
I think so. I know I've raised it with corrections.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is derived from the governor's executive order of 2004.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a different issue in terms of whether at the time there's a court challenge of the civil commitment system, whether or not that will be an issue. But, I mean, you accurately observe that I don't think we've let anybody – we let somebody out once and they went back, right?
Right.
But we've never permanently released somebody from civil commitment. That could be a problem someday.
And Senator Berglund, obviously most of this is visited upon your budget. Members of the committee might recall in last year's supplemental finance bill where we were dealing with a limited amount of dollars to be divided that we ended up using, half the money in the bill in front of this committee for the deficiencies in the commitment programs. And that was, $101 million or something. And just, Senator Berglund, one other comment that obviously, again, it's primarily in your bill, but when members see the Judiciary Finance Bill, it'll be noted that the Supreme Court has asked this year for almost $4 million for psychological services for these purposes. And obviously the money that we had appropriated last year is now in the ongoing budget. But the courts come in and said that for these commitment procedures, you need another $4 million. So obviously that's nothing compared to your budget, but it shows up in other budgets as well. Senator Berglund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to prolong this. Just one last comment, Senator Neville, and that is we didn't create the problem when we passed the civil commitment law. We were only referring about 9 people a year prior to Mr. Rodriguez being released. Now, I think 9 was low, and it had been going down for a number of years. But what we're doing now is utterly and totally ridiculous. It not only is costing the state budget money we can't afford to spend, it is costing the county budgets. I mean, they've got hold orders on all these people they have to pay for. It's costing the court system to process these people. And really and truly, it just cries out for us to look at another way to deal with the problem.
Mr. Chair, I couldn't agree more with you, Senator Berglund. Is there anything that's likely going to come in the Human Services budget to try to direct a study for when we can start releasing? I know for a couple of years I've been asking Human Services, how much longer before we reach equilibrium and the number of people coming in equals the number of people out? And they kind of chuckle. You know, there is no equilibrium in sight yet. And maybe in your Human Services budget bill, you ought to put some language that we start to study that.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Neville, the problem is that we have no control over it in my budget. Once they're in my budget, they've been committed by the courts to the Department of Human Services. That's why I'm asking the questions here and now today, because it's got to be something that's studied by the Department of Corrections, in my opinion. And if I might just add to that, in addition to the people that we get that are sent to the courts for consideration by the Department of Corrections, we have 9 or 10 juveniles between the ages of 18 and 25 who have never been committed of any crime as an adult who are being sent for commitment by the counties to the sex offender programs that the state has. I mean, it's just unreal.
Right.
And Senator Neville, obviously another part of the problem is, separate from what happens administratively, it seems to me that the politics of it have become so overwhelming, you know, that you find, and you, Senator Betzel's got experience, and you've got experience, that the 3-judge panels tend to be very reluctant. I mean, that's supposedly the governor said that if somebody can be released only by virtue of a court order, but the judges are, you know, face some of the same political constraints we do. At the risk of combining issues here, I would commend the committee in terms of the problems with sex offenders. It's a pretty good illustration in terms of the difficulty of treatment and impact on a community. But one of the best five or six movies from last year, Little Children. And if you want to see a pretty good description, that was a good movie. If anybody saw it, it underscores the politics of what we're talking. Sir Anderson, you're looking quizzical at that, but I think it'll be available on DVD in a month or so. So, for the questions, Commissioner Benson.
Chair, I have an amendment whenever you're ready.
Well, Commissioner Benson has a comment. And
Mr. Chair, again, to Senator Berglund's point, we're happy to continue to work with the Department of Human Services on this issue. And I think that there might be a way that we can find some middle ground with respect to keeping offenders in our system longer. But we also, of course, need legislative input on that because it is going to require a statutory change, I think, to bite into that one-third release time. And again, I share your concerns, Mr. Chair, about if we start to keep many people inside of corrections. And as Senator Neville says, nobody ever gets out. It has become the Hotel California. I just think we are, and I'm, who am I? I'm a dumb old prison warden, but it seems to me that at some point the courts are going to look at this and say it just doesn't make sense. And I think that has to be a concern of both agencies, certainly the department and the policymakers that serve on those oversight committees.
Okay. Senator Frederickson,
I have a question for Senator Higgins, not for Commissioner.
Sure.
Deputy Commissioner.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I see one of the line items that was not funded in public safety was pandemic flu preparation. Could you briefly tell us what was proposed to be funded that was not? One of the areas we're criticizing state government, I think, is a lack of long-range planning and lack of anticipation. And this looks to me like something that potentially long-range planning and preparation for something that might occur.
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, the governor proposed $2.2 million to ensure the coordination of state agency infectious disease pandemic preparedness activities and the provision of assistance to local units of government. In the last biennium, public safety had almost $3 million to do this same planning. And, you know, if I'd had a few more million in my budget, you know, I'd have put some in here. You know, at a certain point, when does last biennium's planning become obsolete and this biennium's planning, you know, replace it? I struggled with that quite a bit. And, you know, maybe there's a place to put a little bit of money in here. I'm not sure that, and on top of it, I think the governor requested $20 million or something in Senator Berglund's budget. Say it again.
$27 million.
Yeah.
For pandemic flu.
For the same
preparation.
So the governor had requested a boatload of money for something that might happen this biennium and might not. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pariseau.
Mr. Chair, not to slow down the discussion, but is that in your budget then, Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pariseau, we have sent a one-time funding bill to this committee. And in that one-time funding bill, we have included the request for the antivirals, for the respirators and equipment. Those would be one-time expenditures.
Mr. Chair, I'm
still putting my budget together today as we speak in regard to any planning money.
Mr. Chairman, I went to a conference about pandemics, at which the history of them is that we've had three or four almost every century, and nobody can tell when they'll hit. But obviously the pandemic avian flu is the one that we have to worry about most closely coming to the U.S. And I think that the preparedness goes beyond a single agency or a single level of government. It practically is, it's an international thing that has to be concerned with. And so I just want to make sure that there be something in there for preparedness for our state, as well as we join the U.S. and as the U.S. joins the other continents, because even Europe and some of the Asian countries have avian, and so we have to be prepared for. We don't know when this will happen.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
You can just about name all of them, including the plague and all the different pandemics that have swept the world over the centuries.
Mr. Chairman, during the last biennium, there were federal funds that were sent to Minnesota that supplemented what we did last biennium. And I expect there will be federal funds that will come again during this biennium that will supplement whatever we have in our regular budgets.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Senator Higgins, one of the programs that was cut back, and you mentioned that there was a loss of some federal money, was the sentence to serve program. What implications will the and it also is less than the governor has his budget proposal. What does that mean out there? That to in my area, sentence to serve has been such a successful program, and I think it's been a relatively low cost program for those who participate in it. Does this mean that there will be less use of that program, or what exactly does the amount that you have in there mean? What changes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, give you a little background. For the past 8 years, funding for the county sentence to serve crews has been paid for by carry forward funds from income contracts in dedicated receipt funds. And that was a suggestion from the Office of Legislative Auditor. Then that source of funding is no longer available, they tell us. At the amount that we funded, it would fund 2 to 3 existing work crews. Yep, 3 will be eliminated and 3 will be supported. Continued.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, and I'm sure you probably know, isn't the cost per person incarcerated would a lot less using this kind of an approach than just to have them stay in the jail and serve his time? It seems like, in visiting with the counties that I'm involved with, that they end up working and paying back a portion of their per diem costs either to the county that's sentenced them or to the facility where they're at. And it also has such a positive public reception that it seems like that would be a program we'd want to expand and not cut back.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thanks. Stumpf, they do good work. You're exactly right. You know, they're used to help clean up after floods. They're used on, cleaning up streets in the spring when, you know, all that crud is there that has been accumulating all winter. I think every county uses them in different ways. And as a reminder, these are the nonviolent offenders, so nobody has to worry about, packing up really, really violent folks and putting them out there, you know, working out in the community. I think the money is well spent. I just ran out of money. I like seeing the sentence to serve crews work. I think that it does them good and it does the community good. And if there was a way that I could I could do that, we would. Okay. We don't
Last comment is that it just seems like you know, we just had this long discussion about kind of the cost of sex offenders being civilly committed for life. And it seems like here you have a program that the cost-benefit ratio is relatively good, I mean, in terms of reasonable. And I don't know if the counties will pick it up or not, but it just seems like that's a program that has got a nice, a good tradition.
Senator Neville.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Still on that point, my memory is failing me. This is not what we use for the house building program, is it? Is that just built into the base? There's not a line item, because we have that inmate crew that builds houses. Is that just built into the base?
Mr. Chair, Senator Neville, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, do you want us to walk through the actual language of the bill?
Yeah, and of course, I'm sure there are amendments, and of course we have Senator Betzel's bill on deck, so go ahead.
Mr. Turner's going to do that.
Chairman and members, Article 1 of the bill it basically reflects the spreadsheet, so I'm not going to go through every general fund rider. I'll go through the special revenue fund riders in Article 1 and then through Article 2. Now, the first special revenue rider begins on page 3.4 and it runs through page 3.13. It's a cooperative investigation of cross-jurisdictional criminal activity, $93,000 each year. That comes from the DWI license reinstatement fee, 8% of which of the $250 goes to the BCA. 80% of this goes to lab activities and 20% to this activity, the cooperative investigations of cross-jurisdictional criminal activity. The lab activities, the 80% of the 8%, is the next rider from 3.14 to 3.18. And then from 3.19 to 3.25, we have a trunk highway fund appropriation of $367 the first year and $374 the second. And that's to cover State Patrol DWI lab costs. On page 4.22 to 4.24, Senator Higgins mentioned this. This is about the camera upgrades. If they are upgrading their cameras, there is no match required. If they are acquiring their cameras, a 25% match is required. That was added in division. Then on page 5.34 all the way to page 10, the 800 megahertz public safety communication system, or what we now call ARMOR. And, they're subdivision 7 and 8, and they appropriate the money to design, acquire the sites for, and construct the radio system. If you want any more, if you want to go into detail on these four pages, I believe Mr. Ron Whitehead is here. And he can answer any questions, or Peter Watson.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
It would be nice to know exactly where they're at in terms of the statewide coverage. I can still remember when former State Senator Mike Freeman carried the first bill for the metropolitan area, and I don't think any of us ever thought that it would take this long to get it up and running, but
I never served with him.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Whitehead. I'm the program director for the ARMOR 911 program in the Department of Public Safety. I believe the question was where we are at now presently. And phases one and two, which encompass the metropolitan area, phase one is complete. The backbone was built in 2008. The entire metropolitan area will be all the local enhancements. In other words, all counties will be operating on the system. And I'll just quickly draw to your attention the fact that that led to the rating of the metropolitan area as a perfect score in interoperable communications as rated by the Department of Homeland Security. Phase 3 was funded in 2005, and the Department of Transportation is currently in the process of implementing that in 23 counties outside the metropolitan area, and look to be substantially done by the end of the year. So the governor's recommendation and Senator Higgins' bill would provide the funding for us to complete that system in 2012. I will note that the original plan adopted by the legislature called for annual phasing in 2002, 2003, 2004, and 2005. Regrettably, we've been stalled for about 4 years. And it's appropriate that we move now because we do have some deadlines coming down where we need to get this system in place as a viable alternative.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. White, does that mean that all of our public safety, law enforcement, and emergency services will be able to talk to each other?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it will provide the backbone, provide the opportunity to greatly enhance our interoperability. It will take some time for the local communities to transition, and some have already acquired their own systems, but the backbone will provide the opportunity to enhance that interoperability and that ability to communicate. Yes, you're right.
I'm not sure if that was a direct yes or no, but I'm taking it as a yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson.
Chairman. Mr. Whitehead, you said that in Phase 3 there would be 23 counties added. Which 23?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those 23 counties are southeastern Minnesota from Rochester Patrol District, and then central Minnesota from Stearns County all the way out to Big Stone County on the South Dakota border.
And, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Whitehead, does that leave any areas in Minnesota that are not covered? How about Rock County and Kitson County?
That's only 30 counties out of the 80, so.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, there are still 55 counties that aren't covered. That's where the governor's recommendation does call for us to complete it throughout the state and would pick up Rock County and Kitson County.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Turner.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, the next rider that isn't attached to a general fund appropriation. It's on page 15.22. It was an amendment in the division calling for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to propose changes to the Sentencing Guidelines grid for controlled substance offenses. The proposal must make effective sentences for controlled substance offenses proportional with similar offenses in Minnesota, other states, and the federal government. That's it for Article 1. I'll go through the general provisions of Article 2 now. Page 16.3 it establishes a grant program to mentor children of incarcerated parents. This is the program language. It requires the grant recipient to collaborate with other organizations that deal with at-risk youth. Requires the grantee to ensure the safety of the children and to provide aftercare. That was funded at $500,000 a year for a total of $1 million.
Mr. Chairman?
Mayor Pariseau.
Could somebody elaborate a little bit on who's eligible for grants? I mean, what kind of organizations might they be? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pariseau, the organization who came and talked to us about doing this is Big Brothers Big Sisters, and if you look at the language starting on page 16, they have an existing mentoring program now, and they want to expand to working with these youth who have parents that are in the system, and they will ensure that the mentors are appropriate. They'll do the background checks and all those kinds of things, and they will focus on making sure that the kids don't get into the system to break that cycle of the corrections.
And Mr. Chairman, how much of the state can they cover?
Say it again.
How much of the state can they cover for service of this type?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perez, so right now they're going to focus on the Twin Cities area, and as they go forward, I know that they would like to expand farther, but they're going to start with the piece that they can bite off, and that would be in the Twin Cities area.
Thank you.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, the next rider, Section 2, 16.29, it begins. It was in the governor's bill. Provides that all gifts to the Department of Human Rights be deposited in a special account and appropriated to the Commissioner of Human Rights to help finance the operations of the department. It's fairly technical. Sections 3 and Section 4 have
Mr.
to do
Chair,
with...
Sir Neville.
Let me ask you a question on that. I'm trying to remember the testimony on that. How many gifts and requests and other things do they get each year at the Department of Human Rights?
I wouldn't imagine very many.
I don't think much.
What, in other words, what generated this change?
It's a governor's request.
Mr. Turner, Senator Neville, it was a governor's request. I don't know if there's anybody here from the department who knows its origins.
Chairman, committee, I'm James Kirkpatrick, Deputy Commissioner, and the purpose of this bill was to allow us to accept grants from other agencies in support of our mission. We had the authority to accept it but not spend it. This gives us the authority to spend it.
Okay, thanks.
Good distinction.
Chairman, members, the next two sections, Section 3 and Section 4, have to do with the 800 megahertz public safety radio system. Section 3 authorizes the increase in the 911 services fee by 10 cents each month in 2008, 2009, and 2010. Currently, the fee is 65 cents per line, and this would raise it in 3 years to 95 cents. And that would fund, it was intended that would be enough to complete construction of the system statewide. Section 4, along with the repealer in Section 13, provides that the ongoing costs of operating the public safety radio communication system be allocated by the Commissioner of Public Safety among the users of the system in accordance with the statewide radio plan. Currently, costs in the metropolitan are allocated by the radio board, which no longer exists. This gives the commissioner statewide allocation authority. Section 5 is the result of a mandated legislative task force to make recommendations regarding the management of sex offenders. It expands mandatory sex offender assessments by including the following crimes: Minnesota Statute Section 609.294, bestiality; Section 609.322, subdivision 1, solicitation, inducement, and promotion of prostitution of persons under 18; Section 609.324, other prostitution crimes involving a minor; Section 609.3453, criminal sexual predatory conduct; Section 609.3455, dangerous sex offenders; Section 609.352, solicitation of children; Section 609.365, incest; Section 617.246, use of minors in a sexual performance; and Section 617.247, possession of child pornography. The cost of these additional sex offender assessments is estimated to be $75,000 a year and is in the community services budget of the Department of Corrections. Section 6 through 9 was a Senator Neville bill that increased the value thresholds for four different crimes. Section 6 increases the value threshold for theft. It doubles all the way through from our 10-year felony for theft, 5-year felony, 5-year with prior offenses, 5-year involving special circumstances, grave robbing, pillaging, et cetera, the gross misdemeanor and the misdemeanor. They're all doubled. In fact, the entire bill doubles the value thresholds. Section 7 does the same thing for the value thresholds for issuing bad checks. Section 8 doubles the threshold for criminal damage to property in the first degree, and Section 9 doubles it for criminal damage to property in the third degree. Section 10 directs the Post Board to prepare learning objectives for pre-service and in-service training courses to instruct peace officers in issuing in issues related to domestic abuse orders for protection and no contact orders. Section 11 directs the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group to study the issues involved with the automatic sealing of arrest records for persons who are not subsequently convicted of an offense related to the arrest. It requires a January 15, 2008 report to the legislature. Section 12 establishes a collateral sanctions committee. It directs a study, directs it to study issues related to how criminal convictions and adjudications affect an individual's employment and professional licensing opportunities. It's funded through the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and it is the bill requires a January 15, 2008 report date to the legislature. And Section 13, as I mentioned before, is tied with Section 4. It's a repeal Section 403.31 related to the ongoing operating costs of the public radio communication system. It deletes the section about Metropolitan Radio Board and gives the authority for the whole system to the commissioner. And that's Bill.
Okay, thank you. Further questions on the bill before we take amendments? Okay, if not, no further discussion on any amendments. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to offer an amendment. It's not drafted as an amendment. It's just a bill. So I'll just pass that around. We haven't had time to get it drafted as an amendment. Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill that was authored by Senator Moi, and Senator Moi, at the request of the Attorney General's office, and it was heard and passed in the Judiciary Committee, and it has a very small fiscal note, so that's why we wanted to ask that we consider adding that onto this bill. What it will do is create a crime of solicitation of children to engage in sexual conduct on the Internet, or Internet or computer solicitation of children. And this is an area that's not covered by our current laws adequately. We know that the Internet gives adult sexual predators unprecedented access to children. Research shows that half of teenagers communicate over the Internet with people that they have not met. As a mother of two children who are just learning how to use the Internet, and really it's amazing how magnetic the attraction of surfing the web is to all children. And so I think their vulnerability is absolutely enormous. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children notes that only 25% of children who receive an online sexual solicitation tell a parent. And so what the bill does is makes it clear that that if you use an adult uses an Internet or a computer with the intent to arouse or gratify their sexual desire while either soliciting the child to engage in sexual conduct, communicating with the child in a sexually explicit manner, or distributing sexually explicit material to the child, that is a felony. Under current law, it's a crime for an adult to sexually solicit a minor, but not to engage in sexually explicit communications with a child. Yet we know that sexually explicit communications from an adult to a child can have extremely harmful consequences and oftentimes are the first step being used to groom a child for a future sexual encounter or in-person contact. This is similar to laws that exist in several other states, and there is someone here from the Attorney General's office who can speak to it or answer any questions if the committee desires. Mr. Chair, I know Senator Moi spoke to you about this. The fiscal note shows
a small bed impact, so that it would be a cost in the first year of, they're estimating $12,000, in the second year of $45,000. So it's very minimal, and the tails are slightly higher, but we were hoping that this could be added to the bill, given that the fiscal impact is so small. But the impact on protecting children in Minnesota is huge, and it's a need that law enforcement has to be able to prosecute these kinds of offenses.
Okay, well, I have a couple of questions, and Senator Maud did talk to me briefly, but now I get a clearer sense of it. And I'm going to turn to, well, Senator Higgins, but maybe who serves on Senator Maud's committee? Senator Betzold, Senator Neville? We've had omnibus crime policy bills over the last number of years, and so clearly this is more of a crime policy issue than a crime finance issue. I know that the other body has put together these immense finance bills that just tie in all sorts of crime policy. And I think they're doing the same thing this year, I think, but I'm not sure. And it's always struck me as bad practice. But can I ask, and Senator Higgins, are you also on Senator Maud's
yes.
policy committee? So what did the policy committee do in terms of policy crime issues? Was there any?
Mr. Chair, we sent them all out separately. From if they had a fiscal impact, they got sent to this division. If they didn't, they went on their way. We did not put together an omnibus crime policy bill in our Judiciary Committee. Mr. Chair, we had several bills like this that we heard in Judiciary and some we heard in Division, where there was, a bed impact of one or two or three or five, whatever. This is just one of them. This was not heard in our Division. This was only heard in Judiciary. We closed up our budget, what seems like weeks ago. But I think we all in our, not to speak for the other people in the division, but or the Judiciary Committee, I think we all understood that this was an important issue, and maybe one that we don't quite understand the ramifications of quite yet. But I worry that if this is put in our bill, then Senator Chaudhry will be asking for his bills that had small impact also to go in here, and Senator Berglund had one, and several other folks had similar, small bed impact bills that we might end up with in our division as well. And then at some point they add up.
And Senator Higgins or Senator Anderson, my concern is not relative to the merits of the proposal, which sounds meritorious, but a question of what's the dividing line with these finance bills as to when they become more a substitute for the inability of policy committees or individuals to pass policy bills?
Well, Mr. Chair, to be fair, I'm trying to see if Senator Maud is available, and to be fair, I haven't had a chance to really ask her the detailed answers that I would need to know if this bill is alive as a separate bill in the House. I'm assuming it is. I think the issue is that there needs to be a way to carry the fiscal impact. And so if there's a way to do that without putting the language in the bill, I don't think that's a problem if you're uncomfortable with putting too much policy into the bill. But the question is the fiscal impact. How would that be carried if she just does it as a policy bill?
It's a little bit of a call of Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins has done a very good job from looking at the bill yesterday and then this morning in committee in terms of putting together where her language ties into the fiscal policy quite directly.
Mr. Chair, there's no policy in this bill that isn't tied to financing somehow.
Senator Maud, since you've walked in, Senator Anderson has just presented the bill, and you'd mentioned it to me in passing. The question is not so much the merits or demerits of the bill, but the question of process, since it appears to be strictly a policy bill as opposed to a finance bill. And the question I had, and obviously you're chairing this committee for the first time this year, and I no longer serve on either side of the Judiciary Committee, as to whether or not there had been any consideration to an omnibus crime policy bill as we've done in the past.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for giving consideration to this bill and giving me an opportunity to speak. We did have that discussion in the policy committee, and my initial inclination was that because it was policy, we would bring it to the finance committee, and then I would ask for it to just be sent to the floor. However, in that process and out of consideration for Senator Higgins' budget, I had some concerns that even though it's almost all purely policy, it did have some implications for bed impact. And so there was a concern, and I took into consideration Senator Higgins' input that even though it was all policy, it was my preference to just move it to the floor as a policy bill because of the potential bed impact, as little as it is. I didn't want it to put Senator Higgins' budget in a situation where she would be caught if it goes to the floor. So I'm kind of at a loss on how you want to address this. The other body, the policy committee and the other body has stated a couple of times that they want to do policy omnibus bills. But unfortunately, Mr. Chair, they have yet to identify a vehicle, and I don't have a good sense of what's happening over there. As far as my policy committee is concerned, we've been moving bills out of the committee and onto the floor. It wasn't my intention to create omnibus policy bills. I think there's a number of considerations with trying to do something like that, and Mr. Watson and, you know, counsel is going to help me look at that. We have some concerns about same subject issues. But I'm assuming if the other bodies end up doing an omnibus bills, that we'll have to do something. So at the end of the day, something will be done so that we can match up bills, I'm assuming, because we want to make sure that the good work of the people in this body get sufficient consideration. But on this bill, I'm sort of caught, and I don't think that I'm the only one that's caught in this situation. I know that there are, you know, a couple, two, three other bills that have come through that are strictly policy bills but have potential minor bed impacts. And so I guess, Mr. Chair, I would leave it up to you and this committee to help us make that decision.
And Mr. Chair, the fiscal note shows a bed impact of 4 beds in the next biennium. So I don't know if there's a policy that has to be carried as a line item. When it's such a minimal impact. I don't know what the answer is.
That has not been the case, but Senator Higgins, as the author of the bill, and you serve on the Senate Finance Committee and obviously a member of your division, although not a member of this committee, and you could argue a brief either way, but what are your thoughts?
This is one of those times when I feel like a real rookie, Mr. Chair. When the Attorney General, Attorney General's office came and asked about this bill the other day, I suggested that since the other body hasn't closed its bill yet, they could go get it in that bill, and then it would come into conference, and it would be something we could look at in conference. I just know that it opens the door to a lot of other quasi, you know, policy funding bills that have like a bed impact of 3 or 4 or 5, and we'll end up with all of those to be discussed on the Senate floor.
I don't know if it's fair to put Mr. Turner on the spot. It seems to me in the last several years, in Senator Random's bill, when we created the previous Crime Judiciary Finance Division, that we've had major impacts, those bills have been carried. There's been a major bid impact. I'm not sure about the more minimal ones, but is it fair to ask you if it's been, it's not like this, it seems to me this is kind of on the border, it could go, you know, possibly could be included, but would you like to offer us a little bit of history?
Mr. Chairman, members, historically we've had a line in the spreadsheet for increased bed costs from Senate files, and the House will carry the same line, increased bed costs from House files. And it's really true with some of the big policy bills we had. We had to carry that. A lot of bills like this, used to come back from the sentencing guidelines with just, it's a minimal bed impact, mm-hmm. and it wouldn't delineate, you know, four beds over the biennium. And I think they've gotten away from that because they do add up. So every little bill that we've sent in for a fiscal note has come back with Senator Ma's bill came back one bed in 08 and three beds in
09.
Yeah, and then six in the beds in the two following years. Before it was minimal impact, we just include it in the bill and only include the major policy bills. But there's nothing that keeps us from having that line that we've historically had, increased bed costs for Senate files.
Well, that might argue for inclusion, but Senator Moore.
And Mr. Chair, just let me be clear that it is not my preference to have policy language in this bill. I mean, so if there's a way to put a line in here that would address these minimal bed impact, it is my preference that the policy issues that we deal with, and in the Judiciary Committee, the Judiciary Policy Committee, this is not the first and it will not be the last time when we'll get a purely policy bill. That if it's a penalty enhancement or if it's a, you know, if it imposes a specific kind of penalty, we won't be able to catch it all before all the budget deadlines. And I think that it will continue to happen in that instance where we will get some feedback that there will be some minimal or some bed impact implications, but we won't know for a fact how big that implication is. But it is not my preference that we put policy language into the budget bill just because there's minimal impact. So if you can help me resolve that, I would very appreciate it. Not just for this session, but for, you know.
Well, Mr. Turner makes me a little bit more comfortable with his suggestions on the history, but Senator Anderson, you're making the motion. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm doing this at Senator Moore's request, and I would follow her lead on this, and Senator Higgins. And it sounds like it might be agreeable better from both of their perspectives not to put it in the policy, into the finance, Senator Higgins' finance bill, as long as we can approve that as a finance committee. Just let Senator Moi carry this bill to the floor and try to pass it as a policy bill and know that we have accounted for it. I think that sounds like that would serve everybody's needs and be the most, have the most integrity in terms of the process and the discussion of the policy.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, we did a quick add-up of several of these bills that had the small bed impact and small cost to them. And if we put in an increased bed line, like Mr. Turner suggested had been done in previous years, it would have to be $500,000 for this biennium and $1.1 million for TAILS for the 2010-2011. So while this one is 50,000, 60,000, you know, by the time we add them all up, we're at $500,000. So,
and that's,
you all have done this way longer than I have. So, I'll take, you know, obviously your direction.
And of course that's, you know, in all honesty, now we're seeing, one of the questions about our Senate deadlines where we historically have had policy bills out before finance bills. So the finance bills can take into account the policy bills we have on the floor. And
Mr. Chairman, as the chairman of the Finance Committee, how many divisions would come in with the same model for their services, environment, I mean, I'm thinking economic development, all the different finance divisions? If you had to do that, where could you be?
Well, Senator Parasol, that's why...
On the process.
That's why historically we have cut off... policy debate, you know, before the finance debate ends, so that we could take into account some of this. And we're going to have a discussion about this with Senator Betzold's bill when it comes up, if it comes up, for just, you know, this reason. Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I can't speak to the other policy chairs in terms of, you know, what are the impact is going to be, but it's my understanding that, you know, judiciary is a little bit different or a little bit unique in that we deal with convictions or we deal with criminal penalties. And so for the Judiciary Committee, I think it's a little bit more uncertain because we would often get into that. I don't know how prevalent that situation would be in other policy committees, but I just know that in judiciary, because we deal with purely policy bills would deal with criminal penalties, it would have, you know, subsequent bad impact. I'm not sure that that's necessarily an issue in the other policy committees.
Well, again, Mr. Turner has offered us the history. Senator Higgins, you know, in terms of if you were to pass this bill on its own, could we track it? Again, we're going to have a discussion relative to this with Senator Betzold's bill. My guess is whether we – your budget right now is at a zero balance. So whether we add it to this bill now or we attempt to track it, you'll be out of balance with your target figure. Now, again, we're going to discuss this in a few minutes in a broader way. It's my belief that we'll be able to track this. So I'm not concerned about that right now. Again, depending on what we do with Senator Betzold's bill. Senator Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to withdraw the motion if it meets with everybody's. I don't know what you're saying. If you think we can track it, would you? I guess what's your preference, that we do it in this bill?
Well, it's going to be more a question of Mr. Turner has helped me. It's a question of Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins, I do think that knowing what happens with the State Department's bill, we'll be able to track it. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I just like to suggest, without judging the merits of the discussion or the proposal before us, that if we're going to start spending money in these budget bills outside of the targets, that this will not be the only request that you have.
Well, Senator Berglund, that's a point well taken.
Mr. Chairman, I also, in regard to the earlier deadlines for budget bills, my suggestion, for whatever it's worth, is that we need to have then a deadline in policy committees for budget bills, because I did not get all of the budget bills that people are trying to put into my budget bill in time to have them heard. And it's due to the bills going through different policy committees, ending up in different places, and just not getting to the Finance Committee in time.
No, it's made it confusing, I agree. Sir Moa?
Well, Mr. Chair, I hate to belabor the point, but if that's going to be the case, then all of judiciary policy bills will have to be considered before any budget deadlines. Because, I mean, potentially any and all bills that come through judiciary, particularly in the public safety area, public safety bills that has kind of any criminal penalties would have potential bad impact that accumulates. So I just want to offer that for you to consider. We understood this very clearly when we saw the budget deadlines. We've pushed ourselves very hard in the Judiciary Committee to get any hardcore budget implication issues out there before Senator Higgins' budget deadlines. And the committee members who sit here and understand how hard we've tried to do that. And I'll tell you that I can't guarantee you. I have still about 70 or 80 other bills sitting on my agenda that are policy bills that are going to have minimal budget implications. And, I mean, if that's the case, if we don't try to accommodate that, then basically that means that I'm done for the rest of the session and the policy deadline doesn't make sense. The policy deadline is meaningless for the Judiciary Committee. So I just want this committee to appreciate that it's not – I'm not whining. It's a practical issue of concern for the Judiciary Policy Committee.
Mr. Chairman,
sir,
one last comment. It's good that we have 4 years, isn't it?
I understand the box you're placed in. I mean, that's historically why we've had the policy deadline before the finance deadline. I was chairman of the old Civil Division years ago, and up until recently had always been on the Judiciary Committee. And I know the tremendous workload that, the Judiciary Committee, when we set up the Crime Committee and the Civil Committee, or the Judiciary Committee, and now going back to the combined committee, the workload is huge and gets bigger year to year. So I'm not unsympathetic, but that's also where these change in deadlines have created some problems. You know, we still have Senator Betzold's bill, and we have session, and we might have to come back tonight. Do we have a resolution to this? Senator Higgins, you voiced some concern, but Senator Moore?
Mr. Chair, I would hate to let a really good bill that's really, really good public policy to not get addressed because we have this concern. And this is not just unique to this bill, but I think if we don't find a broader solution, there a lot of good policy that's coming through the committee would get dropped because of the minimal bed impact. So whatever, you know, this committee can help to resolve, I would greatly appreciate it. If you want to create a line or if you can find some money to create a line in Senator Higgins's budget for these types of bills, I would be very pleased. I understand that Senator Higgins has totaled up a number of bills. I'm the only one that's sitting in this room. So until something is resolved, I would like to at least have my little $12,000 ask be addressed.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess my suggestion then would be, if Senator Higgins does not object, is to ask this committee to amend this onto this bill, only because we've had this discussion. And if we put this bill in, it is minimal. And then because we've had this discussion in this committee, it allows us, when it comes up on the floor with other bills, to say, well, it's not minimal anymore.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, maybe the other option would be for Senator Moore and I to look at our bill and see whether we can find a place to find the $12,000 for 08 and $45,000 for 09, and then do this on the floor.
That might be a good way to do it.
You know, where we balance it so that we stay in balance. So if Senator Moore would work with me on that and you would withdraw your motion, then we'll figure out an answer sometime before Saturday.
Senator Moore,
Mr. Chair, I'm perfectly okay with that. And my last comment would be that I would ask this committee to think about the issue that the Judiciary Committee is boxed in for going forward.
So is the Finance Committee on the reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Chair, I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay, further amendments. That was it for amendments?
That's how great a bill we put together,
apparently.
Mr.
Chair, then.
I can think of one I could put in here.
Chair Betzold.
I'll move that Senate File 1992 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay, we have Senator Betzold's amendment, our motion in front of us. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you very much, Senator Higgins.
Thank you all very much.
Mr. Turner, Mr. Baucus. Okay, then we have, we think, a little bit more excitement, Senator Betzold's bill. Well, was after a fashion, Senator Higgins, but Senate File 1997, the State Department's bill. And if we're running a little bit late, so if people are leaving, if you could please keep the conversations not down but dormant, would appreciate it while Senator Betzold starts.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the state government budget bill, and, of course, it was my goal to come on with a nice, simple little bill and do my work in the budget division. Not to spend a lot of time here, I look over Mr. Watson and I see a growing pile sitting, of paper sitting in front of him, so I just call that to the members' attention. This budget division from the state government budget deals with the state agencies that do not fit anywhere else. For instance, I've got the Department of Finance, Department of Revenue. I do not have some of the agencies because they go elsewhere, like the Department of Transportation is within transportation. Education is under the education area, but if they can't fit it anywhere else, I've got it. I've got the state constitutional officers, the governor's office, the legislature, including the Senate and the House. My total budget is less than $600 million, and I often point out to people, I said, we could bulldoze the whole state capitol complex, we could fire every employee within my area, and we still wouldn't have as much money as we needed for the 2005 special session to put money on the formula for education. So just try to put it in context. In my area, we had about $300 million of requests for new initiatives, but our target was $10 million under the base. We had a $10 million cut. So how do we get there? And so the actual bill you have is rather modest. I'll just briefly describe how we got there. First of all, the Department of Revenue does have, and we've done this for a couple of years, have some ability to do tax compliance. There's roughly about $1 billion out there in unpaid taxes. Now, we're not going to collect $1 billion. No matter what we do, some of it's uncollectible, but some of it is collectible. We've already grabbed the low-hanging fruit, so some of the easier ones have been done. But the Department of Revenue said that if they had about $10 million, we could book about $50 million in tax compliance for new revenues. So I started with $10 million in the hole. We spent $10 million more for the Department of Revenue, but that generated $50 million. It put me up to $30 million in the black. However, the first thing we had to do was look at the salary supplement that all the budget bills are looking at, and doing that was about $20 million, which now took me down to $10 million, about $5 million for each of the next years, and that didn't go very far. Now, we were able to squeeze a few extra savings here. The Department of Administration has a deputy commissioner position that's been vacant. They're actually using the funds over for the Office of Enterprise Technology. We use that money. The Department of Employee Relations is merging into the Department of Administration. Okay. The governor's got a proposal on that. Senator Rust has a bill to do that. The initial fiscal note indicated there would be savings of basically one job, the commissioner's job. We worked some numbers. There were some other employees, and we came up with some assumptions that would have increased the number. But that gave us a little bit more room to work with. And basically what the bill does is that after the compensation, we do spend some money on the Senate. We're way behind in some technology. In fact, just yesterday, the servers were crashing as the spreadsheets were trying to be made on this very bill. We're way behind, and we need to do some catching up. And so a lot of the money, frankly, goes to Senate technology. The legislative auditor, we wanted to put $125,000 per year into that. The legislative auditor, there's four accounts that the legislative auditor audits, and these agencies must pay for the audits, but they pay the fee into the general fund. And so what we did was we just took the same amount of money that these agencies are paying for the audits and have them, we have pulled it out of the general fund and put it in the legislative auditor. The Senator Rust actually had a bill that would have had them pay it directly to the auditor. Then you're auditing for fee, and that didn't quite work out right. So we just wanted to increase the legislative auditor's funds. The Legislative Coordinating Commission had a request for about $1 million in addition. We came up with about a quarter of that, but and they still have more needs, but that's the best we could do. The state auditor has some problems in retaining some of their auditors, and because we were able to work some numbers on the fees that they charge and pension aids, we were able to come up with the money to help the state auditor retain some of the auditors there. The Office of Enterprise Technology needs money for state computers. The security system really needs additional resources. They actually wanted about $17 million a year. We couldn't even come close to doing that. We came close to about $3 million for each of the next 2 years and then more after into the out years. One of the really popular initiatives that we had in my budget division was the Land Management Information Center. Now, the governor really did not put any money into this and would have phased it out, it appears. This is something that many organizations, groups, government throughout the state use the database that we have on tracking real estate all through the state. And there's more information we can provide on you, but I'm sure that many of you may have heard about this as well, too. The census is coming up. We can't stop it. In fact, we have to provide money for it. Minnesota is at risk to losing one of its congressional seats in the next reapportionment. And so this is one of the things the governor proposed, and we absolutely had to fund it. The Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board had its budget cut a few years ago. They've been operating as a part-time agency. They really need to be at a full-time agency. This was not a large item, but we were able to find the money to restore it. That is, and the Amateur Sports Commission needed a little bit of funds basically to put them back whole, too, for the biennium, and we did that. So then there's some pass-through monies that some fees that are generated with other boards, the Office of Administrative Hearings, the Racing Commissions, that we track them, but we don't gain or lose any revenue in doing that. Well, we do have an A11 amendment, if that could be distributed, which is a technical amendment. And I'll have Mr. Bodderman wishes to go through the bill, Mr. Chair, we can describe what is in the bill as you have it. There are a number of amendments, as you can see, and there's A11 and A14. A14. Okay. This is a technical amendment, Mr. Chair, and I think if we, whether it's your pleasure to just adopt this right now and then go through the bill, but as I say, this just kind of cleans up some of the things that we had caught in the bill coming to us. Briefly, what it does is that the first part of it, on line 2, deletes some unnecessary language in the bill. On line 1.3, it's just making an internal adjustment for the Amateur Sports Commission. There's some language in the bill dealing with a study that the groups indicated should be expanded to include the state services for the blind. And then there is post-retirement issues where people are retired and want to come back and be able to work in positions. We need to do, and also the and it applies to every other agency, but not the legislative branch. That's something that we've added in here in this technical amendment. Likewise, I did talk to the commissioner of Dewar, and the bill that we have before us had the effective date of the merger of Dewar into Admin next January. They asked for a little bit more time next June. The savings will still be the same amount, and this accomplishes that. So it's basically a technical amendment, Mr. Chair, but you know, we can either adopt it now or after we've gone through the bill.
Well, if you would you prefer
I'll move the A14 amendment now, just to get these items out of the way, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have the A14 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
And there's a number of issues that we need to, but maybe we should just kind of go through the bill first, and so you know what's before us. And then, as I say, we have a couple of things that we need to address before we open it up, Mr. Chair. So I'll turn over to Mr. Bodder.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'll take you through the rider language fairly quickly since Senator Betzel has discussed the new appropriations in the bill. Most of what you're seeing on pages 1 and 2, as a matter of fact, almost everything there is language that's used from biennium to biennium. There is a new rider on page 4 appropriating the money for information technology security to the Office of Enterprise Technology. Then on page 5, you'll see in the middle of that page, the State and Community Services section of the Department of Administration has some of the new initiatives there. Those are as discussed by Senator Betzold. Basically, just about all of the riders directly reflect the appropriation. There's no additional language. On page 7, the same language that was used in the previous biennium for the tax compliance initiative from the Department of Revenue, but you'll see what it looks like there. The anticipated revenue is also set forth on page 7, line 26. Then I think I'm going to move straight through to the statutory. Well, actually, I'll take you to page 11 of the bill. That contains the rider that reflects the intent that the appropriations in this article are intended to fund a 3.25% compensation increase for the agencies included in the bill. Article 2, beginning on page 12, contains the statutory provisions in the bill. Section 1 on page 12, line 6, basically allows the Capital Area Architecture and Planning Board to spend the money that it receives from other agencies that are subject to its review, that pay a fee for that review. It's just a direct appropriation or a statutory appropriation from the Special Revenue Fund to the board. Section 2, and that was contained in the governor's proposal. Section 2 on page 12 is technical language that was brought to us by the Department of Finance and removes an obsolete reference to the Intertechnologies Division. Section 3 on page 12 reduces the authorization for the Department of Administration deputy commissioners. This would reduce it from 2 to 1. And on the top of page 13 is the domestic partner benefit language that would apply to state employees. That bill went through both the policy and budget divisions. Section 5 is a reduction in the amount of deputy commissioners authorized for the Department of Employee Relations. Previously, there was one authorized. I think a total authorization for one, I believe. Then on Section 6, that's language that's related to the domestic partner language. Just says if a collective bargaining agreement provides health insurance for spouses, then it must also be made available to domestic partners as they're defined in this bill. On page 14, there's some language requested by the Department of Finance that allows revenue and finance to cooperate. Revenue can provide individual income tax return to the Department of Finance in order to prepare the revenue forecast. Obviously, that data is treated as classified data. On Section 8, on page 14, is the abolishment of the Department of Employee Relations. And again, the technical amendment you just adopted would change those dates to June 1st of 2008. And you can see those in paragraph C, beginning on page 14, line 19, those duties will be transferred to the Office of Enterprise Technology, the Department of Commissioner of Administration, and the Commissioner of Finance. So the duties of the Department of Employee Relations go in a variety of directions. At the bottom of page 14 is language that was in a bill authored by Senator Betzold that directs the state's chief information officer to study and evaluate how to preserve data and the related hardware, software, and media used to interpret it. The bottom of page 15 is language that it basically continues. This is both it's a request that came from the Department of Employee Relations, and I believe is carried in Senator Michelle's bill that's on the floor. It was an agency bill. It continues an authorization to allow employees in state government to take a voluntary unpaid leave of absence and continue to receive certain benefits. It's both parties have to agree before an employee can take a leave. On the last page of the bill, there's the revisor's instruction related to the Department of Employee Relations abolishment. And the repealer in Section 12 is the Genetic Information Working Group that was established last year. The Department of Administration requested that repealer since no funding was provided to staff that working group. That pretty much completes the review of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bowden.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Betzold.
When we completed the bill, in order to get the bill introduced and get it to here, we had not quite completed the work on the Secretary of State's area. And so if we could have the A7 amendment distributed, this is what we finished off in the Budget Division yesterday. This would have been part of the bill, again, had this information all been buttoned down prior to the bill introduction, but it wasn't. This is budget neutral, and I don't know if there's a tracking sheet on it, but let me just describe. Okay, I'll have Mr. Lundin go through it. But basically what we're doing here is that the Secretary of State wanted to have some voter registration funding, and this bill uses some Help America Vote Act money to do that. So that takes care of that part. They also wanted some money for technology. We had no money for technology, so they have various fee increases in here to help pay for their technology initiatives. Now, let me turn it over to Mr. Lundin to walk through the A7 amendment. This is all Secretary of State's issues.
Okay.
Mr. Lundin.
Taking a look at page 1, Section 7 is the total appropriation to the Secretary of State, and there's one change in the general fund because of some of the fee changes that are going on here. There was a loss to the general fund of $1,000, so we have reduced the general fund appropriation each year by $1,000. And then the special revenue there is the Help America Vote appropriation out of that, the federal dollars out of the special revenue account. And then there's language there that's appropriating any additional money that may be left in that account, you know, over the course of the biennium, that it's available to them. And then if I move down to line 1.29, this is one of the fee changes that's taking place in the bill. And this has a impact to the general fund. It's a non-dedicated receipt of $2,000 a year. And then if I turn over to page 2, there's a temporary surcharge, temporary technology surcharge that the Secretary of State requested, and there's a number of fees you can see there that there'll be a surcharge for the biennium on. And the total of this raises a little over $1 million. It's about $1.1 million for the year. And the Secretary of State is going to use this to do some technology improvements in their business services area and also to maintain a couple of FTEs that they had in the business area. Moving down to...
Mr. Chairman?
Jim Pariseau.
Sorry, did I understand that correctly? Everything, including the fees on Section 1, page 1, and temporary technology surcharge raises $1 million, or is just the temporary surcharge?
The temporary surcharge.
Okay, and how much does the other one
The other
raise?
One is $2,000 a year, and that is a non-dedicated receipt to the general fund, so that is not staying with the Secretary of State. Then moving down to line 2.22, this is... the driver's license, voter registration language, and let's see, moving on to, I'll just pick up again with the fees. On page 5, looking at line 5.26, basically what this does is it eliminates a post-dissolution process notice. So this generates some savings within the Secretary of State's budget related to postage and printing savings. So there's about a $4,000 savings there. We have not captured these savings, but that was one of the reasons we did reduce the general fund appropriation that I talked about at the beginning, just to make sure that everything balanced out after all of the fee changes. So there was not a negative impact to the general fund. Then if you go to page 6, down on line 6.22, there's another fee change here. This is for the non-Minnesota name reservation fee, and there's a $15 decrease there. And this is where we see a loss of receipts to the general fund. So this is a $3,000 a year loss. And so that's between those two fees that I talked about where we net out to losing $1,000 a year in the general fund. And then looking at page 8, if we go to line 8.4, this is some language related to what they can use the money that in the Uniform Commercial Code account. This is where the temporary surcharge dollars would be going. So this just kind of expands what they can use it for. Then going down to line 8.20, this language came from a bill actually Senator Torres Ray had that we heard in the committee, and we took out the fee-related language and put into this bill. And basically what it's doing is standardizing the online and the paper filing fees. Before, the paper fees were $20, and if you did it online, it was $15. And I think some of the counties and stuff were kind of preferred that this be standardized, because people would go and do online and then wouldn't register with them because of the $5 difference. So this standardizes it at $20, and this does increase $880,000 for the year that then goes to the Secretary of State. And what they're going to use these dollars for is when people are doing online transactions and paying with a credit card, there's a $3 fee that they would be charged. So they will be using these dollars to offset so that that $3 fee is not charged to the consumer that's making the filing. And I think that pretty much goes through the fiscal implications of this amendment.
Mr. Chair, there's two changes we have to make in the A7 amendment before I move it. Mr. Bodden will describe them.
Mr. Chairman and members, after looking at this, the same appropriation is made in three different places in the amendment, so I think we only need one. On page 1, lines 1.21 to 1.27 can be deleted. And then I'll point out that on page 2, the language you see beginning on line 16, the appropriation there is all that is necessary to appropriate the money from the temporary technology surcharge. Then I'll take you back to page 8. There's a new appropriation from the Uniform Commercial Code account there. And I'll check briefly with Mr. Lundin. I think the new language here would not be necessary to appropriate the increased fees from the language you see in Section 17. That would be the existing language is sufficient to allow them to implement and maintain the central filing system. So you can delete Section 16, and that statutory language can remain the same. And the effect of doing that will be to limit the appropriation of the temporary surcharge to a two-year time frame.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to incorporate those changes into the A7 amendment. And as I say, this is simply the article for the Secretary of State that would have been in the bill had we had all the information on time. And so we'll now have the bill before you as we wish to proceed. So I'll move the A7 amendment with those incorporations.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, page 2, section 2, could you tell us what the standard fee is for a couple of those fees that will now be paying a surcharge?
We'll need somebody from the Secretary of State's office. Mr. Lundin knows
that. Yeah, I can go through the temporary surcharge, what they're currently the fees are, and then what the increase is. The incorporation articles, the current fee is $135, so that will increase by $25 to $160. The next one, the LCC articles, the current fee is $135. That will also increase by $25 to $160. The foreign articles fee is currently $200, and that will increase by $25 to $225. And then the foreign annual reports is currently $115, and that will increase by $20 to $135. And then the foreign reinstatements are currently $300 and will increase by $50 to become $350.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that this gentleman was stating them in the way they're written here. In Section 2.
Mr. Watson, is
that? Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Lundin read them exactly as they are in the bill.
I mean, the titles that he used are not used in where the new language is here.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, he said a foreign corporation rather than non-Minnesota corporation.
Right, and we all don't know those statutory references that are there that defines that, I'm sure. That's what I was just pointing out.
Okay. Thanks. All right, Senator Betzel, you've got your motion in front of us.
Okay, Mr. Bonner has something.
Mr. Chairman, in conversation with Mr. Black from the Secretary of State's office, he has expressed a preference for the appropriation as you see it in Section 16, which I suggested could be deleted. And that basically amounts to a standing appropriation from the UCC account. There would be no date limiter on that. But that, if you keep that, it would allow you to delete on page 2, lines 16 through 19. The language is identical, and the effect of keeping it in the statute would simply be to keep it permanent.
So, Mr. Chair, then we keep Section 16, but on page 1, delete lines 21 through 27, and on page 2, delete lines 16 through 19. So I'd incorporate
that.
Yes.
All right.
I'll move the A7 amendment. Again, this just puts the Secretary of State's article into the bill.
We have Senator Betzel's motion in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, rather than proceed at this moment with there's a number of amendments because there's other bills, issues flying around that, as we had in the previous bill's discussion, there's just other things trying to marry up here. Maybe we should just spend some time and see if there's any issues or concerns people want to talk about the bill as we have it before us. I do know that the Newer commissioner would like to be heard on one item that's currently in this bill, and then, as I say, I'm prepared to proceed with amendments.
And Senator Betzel, that's what I was going to suggest. If we could have general questions and discussion before we take amendments. Senator Frederickson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, page 2, under House of Representatives, there's some rider language. Could you explain what that is?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, the A14 amendment actually deleted that language. That was inadvertently held over from language from a previous biennium.
Okay. Okay. Other questions for Senator Betzold or for staff? Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, what's going on for the provision that's in here on the domestic partners?
I couldn't hear the question. Sorry.
I'm just one on Section 4 of the bill, Article 2. Just wondering if you have a fiscal note.
Yes, we do.
Domestic partner benefit.
I have copies.
Oh, we've got copies here to be distributed. While the fiscal note's been, Mr. Bodder just noticed one other change we have to make on the Secretary of State's article. If we could just revisit that while people have a chance to look at the fiscal note, we need to clear something up here.
Mr. Bodder.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for the confusion. Again, on the A7 amendment, Senator Betzold incorporated the deletion on page 2 of lines 16 through 19. What we would need to do would be to retain the first sentence of subdivision 2, the and we can change the headnote to deposit, I guess, for the time being. We need to keep the sentence that deposits those fees into the UCC account. So we'll change the headnote to deposit and keep the sentence that reads, the surcharges listed in subdivision 1 shall be deposited into the Uniform Commercial Code account.
Period. So I'll move to reinstate the language on starting on page 16 and... I'd like to move to reconsider the vote by which the A7 amendment was adopted.
All right. With the motion to reconsider, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Betzold.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to remove the A7 amendment, but with the change on page, reinstate the language on line 2, line 6, page 2, line 16, and then the language on line 17 up through the word account. Put a period, and then strike the rest of that sentence, as well as lines 18 and 19. And okay, 20.
All right, we have
do we need 20? We need 20. We keep 20.
Yes.
All right, we have Senator Betzold's amendment in front of us as revised. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Madam, Mr. Chair, then, do we just readopt now the A7 amendment then?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Okay, I'm prepared to proceed now on the... the issue on that Senator Neville raised.
Okay, Senator Betzold.
I believe that the fiscal note has been distributed. Let me give you some background here. As I think members of this committee may remember, I don't think I've got a copy of it. A few years ago, through the collective bargaining process. There was an agreement to adopt domestic partner health insurance benefits. That was not accepted, though, by the legislature when the Minnesota House of Representatives did not accept that. So that was not accepted when that contract was ratified. At that time, and this was about, 4 or 5 years ago, I believe that the impact was on about 85 employees. This has raised the number to, 389 employees. There is no direct cost to the general fund or to the targets that I have before us. There is a cost within the agencies because this is an insurance issue, and insurance is paid for both by the employer and the employee. To the extent that the employee is paying it, that is what the employee pays as the employee share. To the extent that the employer is paying the cost, this, like other costs for employment, does come out of the agency's area. But this is not an item that has been booked within this budget.
And as long as Senator Betzold were on the this particular issue, Commissioner Anderson had asked for the opportunity to testify. So for segueing into this particular issue in your bill.
Okay, maybe over here. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll leave my testimony at the fiscal note. I think.
I'm sorry, if you could identify yourself.
I'm Pat Anderson, Dewar Commissioner. Thank you, Senator. We handed out, I think you should have just received it, a note describing the fiscal note and the issues as it relates. I want to make it very clear that there is a cost to this, and it is a cost to the agencies. The fiscal note's about $1.8 million. Should the legislature decide not to fund this directly, this would be essentially a cut to agencies across the board. This isn't something that is swallowed by the insurance program. The insurance is self-funded. Those costs are laid out in the premium structure, and those premiums are charged to the state agencies across Minnesota state government. Traditionally, when there have been legislative mandates in regard to changes in insurance, they have been funded by the legislature up front. And so it's an issue for this committee. It's really a policy issue for you. But if this is not funded on the top end, because it is a general fund expense through the agencies, it would mean essentially cuts to agency budgets in this amount. The fiscal note was done through CGIP. Another way that we could have done it is done it as a percent of agencies' employment. But then you'd have every one of your state agencies making estimates. They would have asked us how many people do you think would sign up for these benefits. And so you would get every state agency giving you small little fiscal notes. So it comes from CGIP, which isn't a general fund program, but it really truly is a cost to the state agencies.
Thank you. Commissioner, let me ask a couple of questions. First, maybe I'm going to ask Senator Betzold. I think, Senator Betzold, you indicated that you questioned the numbers that you've received. Is that?
I don't have the fiscal note from the last time this was before, but it does seem to have jumped from 85 employees to, 300 and close to 400. And I think the cost is Mr. Lindeen might have a better handle on that, but the numbers have seemed to change quite a bit. But.
Mr. Lindeen, do you have anything to offer?
Well, all I can add is, the fiscal note says that in 2002 there were 84 individuals, and the estimate that the department has come up with is estimating 389 employees or their dependents. So I guess I would let Dewar respond.
And, was that last fiscal note, was that 2 years ago?
I don't have the fiscal note from 2 years ago. They referenced the cost in 2002 in the current fiscal note, so those are the numbers that I'm referencing
okay.
here.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner, did... Commissioner, did you want to respond? Or?
Senator, if I can. The numbers, the 89 is simply the people that had signed up during that few-month time frame when we had this. The numbers that we put in the fiscal note came from survey results of how many people have domestic partners statewide, what we thought the percentage would be that would sign up for these benefits. So that's the number that, and there is really no way to tell, obviously, but the number, when this occurred several years ago, it's true that the number was 89, but as you know, this was was a very short-term thing, and it was under a cloud of whether this was going to actually become a reality or not.
Senator Pappas, I think this is actually your legislation.
It's my legislation, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I did want to clarify what Ms. Anderson said, is that was the actual number of people who signed up for it, not the fiscal note. Projection of who would sign up for it. I don't know what that projection was. But there are a couple things that will hold down the numbers, and one has to do with tax consequences, because domestic partner benefits, unlike spousal benefits, are considered imputed income by the IRS. There is a significant tax penalty for families that sign up for this coverage that are domestic partners. And the other thing is, I think the program will continue. People might still continue to be a little insecure and wouldn't necessarily rush to sign up if they had other options. It'll probably be the people who have no other options, and I think that's what kept the original numbers down, is it was the insecurity involved, but it was the people who had no other options.
Commissioner, this might not be a question best directed toward yourself, but obviously this is an issue that's been around the legislature, certainly since it was bargained for. And I don't know that it would be a surprise that it would come back in front of the legislature. Is this something – so if there was a concern about cost, was there any question as to covering the cost in the governor's budget?
Mr. Chair, in the governor's budget at this cycle?
Budget. This, I recognize you're not the budget director or the commissioner of finance, but since you're here testifying –
Senator Cohen, I think I can answer that. There's no – the governor didn't have any money allocated for this in his budget.
Yeah, but your testimony is we can't do it. It's a mandate. It's been an issue that certainly has been around, and that's why I wonder – so clearly the governor didn't allocate money, but I wonder if – why not? Since there would have been a good expectation that this would have come in front of this year's legislative session.
Senator Cohen, the governor, as you know, allocated 2% across the board in his budget originally for salary increases and benefits. And we go to bargaining, which we've started now in the last couple weeks. We're starting the new bargaining cycle. We end up with a pot of money, and a lot of that's determined by what's passed this legislative session. But we have a pot of money, and that money, it's not endless. We have what we have, and so then we go and bargain with the unions with a limited amount of money. And within that, we have to have trade-offs, whether that is percentage increases in cost of living increases or additional co-pays or higher premiums for health care that the employees would pay, higher part of their share. But we do have a limited amount of money. If the legislature was to pass this and not fund it, that would come off the top of how much money we would have to bargain with. And so it would have an effect. There are other things that this legislature is looking at, such as allowing you to cover your kids until they're 25, whether or not they're in college. That has a $6 million fiscal note. That's another issue. So everything that the legislature would mandate on the front end of bargaining becomes dollars off the top for other things that the unions may prefer or want. Or this process is backwards in the sense that usually the executive branch bargains and the legislature ratifies or rejects, which is what has happened. Now the legislature is considering mandating things in bargaining, which means we have less options for other things.
Chairman. Senator Pappas.
I'll let Senator Metzen.
Senator Metzen.
Now this $1.8 million, which this is fourfold what it was a couple of short years ago, that estimates that it's up to 390 or 400. I thought you were saying that 85 enrolled or had the option enrolled just a couple of short years ago. But let me continue on. The $1.8 million you're suggesting, Pat Anderson, is over all of the agencies that we deal with. Senator Betzel?
And Mr. Chair, I don't believe that this is a, and I'll have to rely upon
if it is 1.8.
I don't think that this is a 1.8 cost to the general fund. I think this is spread out in a lot of areas, not that, just.
That's exactly my point. I mean, mm-hmm. You've got a $317 million budget, and if you spread the 1.8 out all around, it ain't a big deal. It's not a big deal. You're making it sound like it's the end of the world, but it's not a huge amount when you look at a $317 million a year budget here. I just don't – I think it's nonsense to even be talking about this.
And, in fact, Senator Metzen, if I'm not mistaken, and Commissioner, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're carrying in all the bills a 3.25% pay increase for the state employees. And the administration has suggested a 3.25% pay increase, but I think budgeted is actually less than that. So there's already some give built into the state budgets, I assume, in terms of what may be bargained for throughout state employment, which would be a huge amount over this particular amount, whether it's 400 or 300 or 100. Mm-hmm. So the administration is already doing that in that respect, I believe. Am I mistaken in that, or?
Senator Cohen, the bargaining hasn't been completed yet, and so the dollars may have been allocated, but rates of cost of living, the rates that are actually going to be bargained for and approved, have not been mandated by either the governor or the legislature.
Well, I don't presume to suggest how your agency ought to handle the bargaining with the state employee units, but this is just a wild guess that if the governor has suggested 3.25, I'll bet what comes back out of the bargaining is not at 2%. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to mention one thing in that I'm not entirely sure how this works, but I know that there was a holiday in November. There was $19 million that was overcharged the state agencies by CGEP and for health insurance costs. And so, you know, $2 million of that went back to the employees and $17 million went to the agencies. So, you know, this is a very small amount in the context of when the estimates of the cost can fluctuate that much. We really don't know. And we don't know how many are going to sign up. Last time we did the program, it was a very small number. This was bargained before. It apparently is something that the unions want. If the legislature rejected it, I think it's the legislature's option then to change our mind and say, okay, let's go ahead and provide the coverage so that families are treated like families equally and fairly.
And this is just a wild guess, and this isn't directed toward Commissioner Anderson. She, fortunately or unfortunately, is here representing the administration, but this is not what her testimony is. I'll assume the objection on the part of the administration, this is just a guess, and maybe others, is not so much the cost as other considerations with the program like the policy itself. That's just a guess.
Good one.
That's a pretty good guess, Senator Benson?
Good guess. Sir.
Okay. Further discussion, we've had a discussion of the fiscal note and questions for Commissioner Anderson or anything else, Commissioner, you might wish to say? Is that okay? I appreciate your testimony. All right. Further discussion on the bill. Further amendments? Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A5 amendment.
Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure it's been distributed.
Okay. Well, while it's being distributed, this is actually a clarification of language that we have in existing law, the duties of contracting agency, and it in terms of how they recalling people off the seniority list before going outside and contracting out for, you know, really for permanent positions. And this did pass the policy committee, but not in time to be considered. We don't think it has a fiscal impact, but because it involves contracts, it needs to be in a fiscal bill.
Senator Metzl.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas was out of the area, but the budget division did hear this as well, too. Senator Rest presented on her behalf, but Mr. Lindeen can probably talk about the fiscal or lack of fiscal cost here. So.
Yeah, we did have a fiscal note completed by the Department of Administration, and it came back with no cost.
Okay, we have Senator Pappas' amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Carries.
Mr.
Senator Betzel.
Chair, I've got a couple of amendments that probably should be considered for the bill, but if we could have the A15 amendment distributed. And I'll describe it as it's being distributed. This is a part of a bill that I'm carrying. It was Senate File 624, dealing with marriage license fees. And the bill is actually heard in both the Judiciary Committee. The bill is currently in the Finance Committee, and it is in the was heard in the Judiciary Budget Division. This raises the marriage fees for the counties, so there's not really a state fee. When my parents got married in 1948, they paid $2 for their marriage license in Hennepin County, and only the county received the money. At some point down the road, the state, I think it was in the early 80s, the state
got part of the marriage license fee, and the state's fee has been increasing over the years, whereas I don't think the county portion has been increased, I think, since the 1980s. So it actually costs the counties, they can only charge $15, when in fact it costs them $25 to issue the marriage license. And the state, of course, has already been raising its fee along the way. So this basically raises the county portion of it. It is not a state impact. And it raises money for the counties.
Okay, we have Senator Betzold's A-15 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I've also got the A-2 amendment. And I'll describe this. This is not a cost issue, but it deals with some funding issues. And this deals with the Sesquicentennial Commission. Senator Pariseau and I on, as are Senator Jen Olson and Senator Rest. And this commission has been meeting to prepare for the state's 150th celebration from statehood next year. Now, this was actually passed last year. But there will be an appropriation, I believe, in the economic development bill coming before you later, before this committee later. However, one of the things that we do need to clarify is that the commission can accept gifts, grants, donations, revenues, and so forth, which they currently are not allowed to do so. And frankly, they're going to have to do that in order to raise the money for it. So this is one of the issues that I've been asked to consider for this bill. There's no cost here, but this just allows the Sesquicentennial Commission to accept funds above and beyond what the state is going to give them, which is probably not much.
We have Senator Betzold's A-2 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And Mr. Chair, if we could look at the A-6 amendment. This is a bill that I'm carrying and was heard yesterday in the state and local government oversight committee. This does not have any fiscal impact whatsoever, but it is a clarification to the law. And it's something that, frankly, let me give a little bit of history here. This deals with the reappointment of commissioners for a governor who's been reelected. Now, this is not going to affect what happened after Governor Pawlenty was reelected and reappointed the commissioners, but the issue came about because of some vagueness in the law. It's quite interesting. Governors used to only have two-year terms up until 1962, and sometimes commissioners had two-year terms or four-year terms or even six-year terms, and not all the commissioners were even appointed by the governor. The Education Commissioner was appointed by the Board of Education. By the late 1960s, the law was changed so that commissioner terms were lined up with the governor's term of office. However, then another issue came about when a commissioner was appointed. The commissioner stayed on even if the governor left midterm, which is what happened when Governor Wendell Anderson left after 1976. Lieutenant Governor Perpich became the governor, but he wound up with Governor Anderson's commissioners. He couldn't appoint his own because they were appointed, and he could not change that. Now, one of the things that the law requires is that when a governor makes an appointment, the commissioner term has to be for the period of time of the governor's term, so that when the governor is elected, those commissioners can serve that term and no longer. In the case of Governor Cui, Governor Ventura, the governor served his term, the governor left office, the commissioners left office with the governor. In the cases since of Governor Perpich with his two terms and then Governor Carlson, they had to reappoint their commissioners even though they were serving reelected to a second term. And that's the same thing that's just happened. But the law doesn't quite clearly state what happens. It does say what happens now if the governor vacates office in the middle of the term. It doesn't say what happens one way or the other. This clarifies that. As I say, it doesn't affect what's Governor Pawlenty's appointments because that's already been done, but I think it clarifies it for the future. It also states, by the way, that an executive order that the governor issues will continue for 90 days after the governor leaves office, whether so as opposed to just leaving office midterm. So
And that's what I think we would want to do, is to give a new governor an opportunity to have the executive orders. As I said, there's no fiscal impact, but this is an issue that it has come up this year. I was asked to carry the bill. I don't think that the executive would have any problem with it because it doesn't affect anything that's happening now, but it does clarify for the future.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, we had a lengthy discussion with Senator Mall about the bill she had that did have a small fiscal impact. As far as I can tell, this has no fiscal impact at all. So the question I have is, why are we considering it in the Finance Committee, particularly when the policy deadlines are out into the future at some
budget trends?
Well, Senator Fredrickson, we've allowed consideration of smaller policy issues as related to the budget. I assume Senator Betzold is looking at some of the attendant costs with the issuance of executive orders. You have to speak to that.
Chairman, he said there's no fiscal impact. He said that twice.
I don't know that there would be, but it was sent to the Finance Committee. The bill was sent out of state and local government to the Finance Committee, and so the bill is technically in the Finance Committee now.
You know, Senator Ferguson, you've been here longer than me, and I recognize there's always this kind of fine line. You know, we're going to have a bill in the committee on Saturday morning, which has an amendment that was added in a division that has nothing. Well, I hesitate to characterize it, but I'm not sure it's a finance amendment. Obviously, we've had rider language dealing with state departments over the years. It struck me that this wasn't huge new policy and had some relationship, without a fiscal impact, still had a relationship to the budget in terms of what would happen with executive orders. And Senator Betzold is, I can tell you, over the last several years as chairman of this committee, the person who's been on me all the time about, you know, being careful is Senator Betzold. Of all the division chairs, this is not meant to impugn any of the division chairs at this table, but if anybody has been careful, it's been Senator Betzold.
Okay. Move the amendment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is a small committee. There's only 12 of us on this committee. You chair a very powerful committee. I would like to see us stay focused entirely on finance and issues that relate to finance, and I don't think this does. And certainly Senator Betzel could offer this amendment on the floor, and we could have a discussion among all the members there.
Well, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a different issue. It's one issue if this is something new that Senator Betzel is bringing into the Finance Committee, but it passed the Policy Committee already. I don't know why it wasn't sent directly to the floor instead of to the Finance Committee. Sometimes, you know, in the other body, they may be wrapping their policy into their Finance Committee, so you can be orphaned if not. So, you know, it's already passed the Policy Committee.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Sir Neville.
I guess the observation I'd make is that if you're going to make an exception and put this on the bill, I think the bill is in fair game for other policy matters, and I hope that we don't, if the minority offers those amendments, that we don't hear an argument back that there's no fiscal consequence, and so therefore it's not germane to the bill. If you're going to start adding policy with no fiscal notes to this bill, which is a budget bill, then it seems to me it should be permissible when and if we offer amendments on the floor.
So in other words, Senator Neville, you're looking for consistency in the legislative process.
As much as possible.
Is that my understanding?
As much as possible.
Well, we can always try to hold ourselves.
I don't set the agenda around here, Mr. Chair, but consistency would be nice.
Senator Betzold.
It was Senator Rest directed to come to the Finance Committee, so that was her direction. So.
Well, obviously, the issue has been raised. You know, we don't have germaneness rules in a committee, obviously. Senator Betzold, is this you're making the motion?
I'll make the motion, yes.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Neville.
Let me ask Senator Betzold a question on Section 1 of this amendment. Does a governor leave office every 4 years, or does for example, if Governor Puente would have issued an executive order, does it carry over into the second term, or does he have to reissue it again? In other words, when does he leave office?
Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, I believe that this would say that whenever the governor leaves office, so if the governor serves two terms, he hasn't left office.
Okay.
So any executive orders – now, if a governor leaves during the term, then the executive orders continue for – expires 90 days, you know, and then the new governor can issue executive orders. But right now, the executive orders would only expire when the governor vacates, that is, leaves midterm. It would not necessarily carry over. And frankly, when a new governor takes over, there's a lot of things happening, and issuing new executive orders may not be at the top of the list, or they might be. But, Mr. Chair,
Senator Neville.
Senator Betzel, you don't consider the word leave to be synonymous with vacates, and it's intended to make a substantive change?
In fact, Mr. Watson can discuss that. Vacates has a very specific meaning in the law as opposed to leaves, and I think Mr. Watson can probably address that better than I can. So.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, as Senator Betzel has indicated, vacate is a term used in our law to indicate that somebody has departed the office before the end of a term, death or resignation or whatever. And that's not what is supposed to be happening with these executive orders, that just because the governor serves another term, that doesn't mean that the executive order should expire. The executive order should continue through subsequent terms. But on the other hand, the commissioner who has been appointed to serve for the term of a governor should have to be reappointed in the second term. And the reason for that language in line 11 about the term ending when the governor who appointed the commissioner vacates office was added back in 1977 to address the Governor Rudy Perpich problem that Senator Betzel described.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Watson, I was mostly asking about Section 1 and the distinction between using the word vacate and leaves. So if I understand it, the word vacate would mean that a governor doesn't finish his term. Using the word leave allows it to go from term to term. He doesn't leave till he's done or doesn't get reelected to the next time.
Mr. Correct? Chairman, Senator Noble, yes, that's the intent of the difference.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, we have Senator Betzel's amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A-16 amendment.
Do I get the count? No.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that extends the pay equity program to contractors that bid with the state in excess of $500,000 and have more than 40 full-time employees. And this bill did pass the State Government Policy Committee, and it was in the Judiciary Committee, and so it missed the opportunity to be considered for the division bill. It has been changed slightly from the form it was presented in the policy committee, and that is instead of having the Department of Human Rights certify the businesses, we're having the Department of Employee Relations, which already has an equity pay a pay equity unit and has experience in doing this. And the additional person that would be required, because right now there's only one person that does the certification for pay equity, would be paid for through a fee of $75. And the way the bill works, actually it was a suggestion from Mr. Chairman, is the fee begins, but the certification process fee begins immediately in 2007 in July, but the certification process comes in later. So there's an opportunity to actually raise the dollars to hire the employee, so we don't need any startup money. A clever approach. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A16 amendment.
Senator Betzel.
It does raise a fee on page 1, line 28, and the proceeds are to be used to pay for it. We don't have a fiscal note on this, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, so we don't know if the numbers are going to work. Hopefully at some later date we're going to know a little bit more about this, but right now we don't. There is a slight amendment that has to, a technical amendment that has to be made on line 27. It says the commission shall collect a 75. It should be the commissioner shall collect a $75 fee.
I'll incorporate that into my amendment.
Okay. Well, and certainly, Senator Betzel, you've raised the question of whether or not the fee will.
I don't know if it's going to pay for the program or not.
So. We'll have to get a sense of that as the matter, as your bill proceeds, if this goes on, and then certain happens, we would arguably have to raise the fee in a higher level.
If it throws the bill out of whack, I got to do something with it.
Yes.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
I think for good policy, wouldn't it be better to wait until we have a fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stumpf, we did have a fiscal note from Human Rights, and we did have a startup cost, and so we felt that the Human Rights fiscal note was actually kind of out of whack. They said they needed like five people to do what one person in the Department of Employee Relations has been doing. So we just thought that since they weren't so experienced at doing it, it'd be better to put it in a unit where they had experience and they already had procedures in place, and one person has been doing the work. And the $75 fee is very close to covering the cost of one person to do the work. So we know how many businesses are likely to be contracting with the state. So I think it might just have to be adjusted. Plus, we're not even hiring the employee for the first half of the program, the first half of the year. So,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, and I'm not explaining it very well. No, you've explained it. It's just that I think for the Finance Committee to take action on something where you don't have a fiscal note, we generally should have a fiscal note to see exactly what's happening. I mean, we can disagree with a fiscal note, but we don't even have a fiscal note to disagree with.
Senator Pappas, do you have any numbers?
I thought we did actually have a fiscal note, but I don't seem to have it in my file.
We could probably get it by the time it gets to the floor.
Okay.
Do you want, Senator Pappas, you're nodding your head. Does that suggest?
We can try to get a fiscal note from Doer by the time it gets to the floor.
Okay.
Since
so you
we
want
change
to do this,
agencies.
Do you want to do this on the floor then?
It's up to the chairman. I could offer it on the floor, I suppose.
Well, if we're not sure about the cost, if we find, you know, this is a couple hundred, you know, if it's a matter of a rounding error, that might be one thing. If it's going to end up being significant, Senator Betzel, do you have any sense of?
Again, I don't know what the impact is. As I say, if a fiscal note comes in, and I can't have my bill out of balance. We'd have to dump it or change it or whatever. And it's supposed to be brought up before on Saturday, so there's not a lot of time to work out these details. So,
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I think that we could adjust the fee to deal with the fiscal. If there was a fiscal note that was higher than the $75, we could adjust it to $100.
Okay.
Remember, we're talking about businesses that contract in excess of $500,000 with the state. So a $100 filing fee is not going to be a significant problem for them.
Mr. Chair, I'm told a fiscal note could be available by tomorrow. So okay. Maybe the prudent thing would be to do the get the fiscal note, and then Senator Pappas, if you want to offer on the floor, then we can take a look at it there when we know the impact.
That's
all right, that's fine.
Senator Frederickson.
I'll withdraw my amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, could I raise an issue mm-hmm. about this with your question? Would this apply to large contractors like MnDOT highway contractors where they're already covered by Davis-Bacon and the prevailing wage laws where their salaries are set for those projects that are bid? I'm thinking about them being required to comply with Davis-Bacon, prevailing wage, comply with all that paperwork, and then in addition need to comply with this when it would just be like very superfluous. I just asked you to consider that,
okay.
or have your staff make a question about that.
I think it does apply that. To them. And the paperwork for this is fairly minimal.
Senator Pappas.
She's withdrawing.
I withdrew it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I've got the A8 amendment. And I'll describe it as it's being distributed. This is another bill that has been through the process. It's from Senator Rest. This would create a Minnesota Commission on New Americans, and it went through the State and Local Government Operations Committee. It's also, I believe, been through the Senate Rules Committee because it would appoint legislative members to this new group. In the budget division yesterday, the cost to the Legislative Coordinating Commission was eliminated. There does appear to be a cost of $2,000 starting in fiscal year 08. However, I think the intent of the of Senator Rest was that the cost be basically paid for by use of legislative staff and per diem, which we are already covering, I believe. Well, the cost is for the citizen appointee. I'm sorry. We are covering the LCC with additional money, not as much as they need in this bill. It's my hope that at some point in this process we can increase the Legislative Coordinating Commission even more. But since we are increasing their appropriation, I think that we can cover this $2,000 citizen cost as well, too, Mr. Chair. So, as I say, this bill has been through the process and was approved by the and we do need to get rid of on page one, lines 1.3 through 1.5, I do not need that language, just from 1.6 forward.
All right. We have Senator Betzold's A8 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, that's as far as I can go.
All right.
With the targets that I've had.
Okay, then I've got some amendments. Senator Metzen, could you chair the committee? Would that be okay? Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cole.
Chairman, I've got a couple of amendments. If I could start with the A10 amendment.
A10. And start explaining it,
okay.
Senator Cohn.
All right, Mr. Chairman and members. This amendment is something that I've worked on with Senator Bach, Representative Lencheski, a number of other members. The Finance Committee, more so than other committees, is aware of the feast or famine aspects to the state budget over these last several years. And we've had extensive testimony in front of this committee during this year's session relative to where the budget's going. And this suggestion actually is derived directly from discussions with people on the Council of Economic Advisors, some of the others who have spent time in front of our committee, Mr. Kudrowski, as an example, former State Finance Commissioner. And when you take a look at the long-term budget trends, and the instability of the state budget, it would appear that if we continue where we are, that that other than some of the large budget drivers, we continue to have significant problems, run into continued shortfalls. And it struck us that This might be an appropriate time where I think many people in the state do have the sense that we kind of lurch from crisis to crisis, that it might be an appropriate time to look at some kind of budget commission. I'm not one who's been a fan of setting up commissions here or there, but I've found a frustration as finance chairman that we have not had the ability to have not even a question of prediction of revenues, because the state forecast is accurate, but to look at the long-term budget trends, to look at where revenues match up or do not match up. And so I would like to establish this commission, to not have it be a political commission, to not have legislators on it, to have hopefully some of the finest minds in the state appointed by the governor and by the legislative leadership to a commission to provide some kind of I guess I'll suggest guide to us. And so that's what this amendment does. It calls for a cost. I should indicate that this is not against Senator Betzold's target. This will be – this is a one-time cost that will be carried against the one-time target. And I think this is something that we clearly need to do. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A-10 amendment.
Senator Cohen has moved the A-10 amendment. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Cohen, do you have another?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members, I have the A9 amendment.
It's the A9.
Vision doesn't work.
You'll see how this all fits. Not this first one, but how these next Mr. Chairman, is this being distributed?
I think you can start.
Senator Betzold doesn't have a copy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman and members, I've had this discouragement over these last several years, again, as we've lurched from crisis to crisis within the budget. We have heard time and time again about the need for cost cutting, for living within our means, for sharing the pain. And I'm struck, and this is not just relative to this administration. I had the same complaints. In all honesty, I wasn't chairman of the Finance Committee, but had the same complaints at times with the Perpich administration, had the same complaints with the Carlson administration. For most of the time during the Ventura administration, until last year, we were fiscally in decent shape, so maybe I didn't raise it with the Ventura administration. But we never seemed to visit the pain upon the higher levels of state government. I've had a fairly broad proposal in the past, which I think was maybe unwarranted. And so what I'm attempting to do with this amendment is to structure it a little bit more carefully. I'm going to ask for a little bit of help from Mr. Watson and Mr. Mossman in just describing what's in the amendment in terms of unclassified positions. I should also add, Mr. Chairman, that this amendment is appropriate for Senator Betzold's bill, although it does impact, and I have talked to other division chairmen about this, it does impact other divisions. But I think that this is something that, again, we keep on hearing the rhetoric, and my attempt with this amendment is to narrowcast it a little bit more than in the past, but still have the rhetoric match up to our legislative actions. So I would ask, I'd move the amendment, but ask Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Watson, Mr. Mossman might comment on how we've done that.
Mr. Watson or
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, committee members, this language, there is, as you will recall from the earlier testimony, some language in Senator Betzold's bill at this time that does eliminate a position at the Department of Administration and also deals with a merger of the Department of employee relations. This language would, in Section 1, limit the number of deputy commissioners for every state agency to one, which I believe would eliminate five deputy commissioner positions in state government. And then it also eliminates the authority for assistant commissioner positions, which I believe the latest numbers we have on that is that that would eliminate 34 positions in state government. And it also, on page 3, line 5, restricts relative to current law the length of time by which individuals can be hired into temporary unclassified positions from, I believe it is, 3 years to 18 months. The savings, there is, as a result of this, savings that would result to the general fund. That is what you see back on page 1 on lines 1.10 and 1.11. These numbers here are based on an estimate of numbers provided to us, of savings provided to us as a result of eliminating these positions from the Department of Finance. And this would just say that the Commissioner of Finance must find at least this amount of savings as a result of eliminating these positions. And that money then would remain in the general fund.
Okay, Senator Cohen renews his motion. Discussion? Senator Neville.
I'd like to just make sure I understand. You said 34 assistant commissioners eliminated out of how many?
Chair, Senator Neville, I believe that's all of the assistant commissioner positions. Each agency would be allowed to have one deputy commissioner.
Okay, so that's
which I believe is a net reduction of five deputy commissioner positions.
And five deputies eliminated out of 20? I'm not sure how many deputy commissioners there are.
Mr. Lundeen is.
Lundeen, do you have the?
Yes. Currently, there are 10 deputy commissioner positions, 3 of which are currently filled. There are 38 assistant commissioner positions, and that's 34 of those are currently filled.
Okay, so Mr. Chair.
Neville.
So for the Department of Human Services, which has probably thousands of employees, you're saying they'll get one commissioner and one deputy? Is that under this?
You want to ask maybe the,
He's shaking his head, yes. Senator Cohen, you think that two appointed people can effectively manage huge departments like that without having, these are the discretionary folks, right, that are supposed to be implementing whoever the governor's policy is. But
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, yes.
Okay. I disagree. I'll vote no on this one. Thank you.
Right. Further Chairman. Discussion on the Cohen A9, Senator Cohen's A9 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
I have one other amendment, but it's going to be an oral.
Interesting.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
This is an oral amendment that I hope members will allow. And Senator Betzel began his discussion with the fact that he has a negative target. Mr. Chairman and members, in preparing targets for the divisions, I did something that I have not done in the past. But because of commitments we had made, particularly in Senator Stump's bill, which is the priority for everyone, I think, I was forced to spend down without holding a reserve account. And we're running into some problems. I mentioned yesterday that Senator Murphy's bill is out of balance by $66,000. Now, with work we did subsequent to the committee, it's actually slightly larger than that. You know, that's a rounding error, but I did not hold a reserve account in place. We also have a significant problem that's come up with another bill that we haven't heard yet, and a much more significant problem relative to how certain monies were counted.
We've got a Senator Cohen, the copy of your amendment is at the desk. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm not duplicating House action, but there's been a lot of talk about the compliance effort. Senator Betzel talked about this. There is a sense that with a little bit more effort, we could regain some revenue. And so this expands the compliance effort that's in Senator Betzold's bill. It does not go to the extent that the House does. And my hope, in all honesty, Mr. Chairman, members, is to keep most of the money on the bottom line. But it's very clear over the last couple of days that to be able to do these bills successfully, we need some adjustment. The other thing I'll mention, and this will not be my amendment, but in discussion with Senator Betzold, his position, and legitimately so, was that his target was the only one that was a negative target. And he felt that if this was to be carried in his bill, and I agreed with him, that it would be appropriate to look at some limited additional revenues. So, Mr. Chairman, I think this works. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mossman might wish to comment on the amendment itself, but I'd move the A-17 amendment.
Senator Cohen has moved the A-17 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, those conclude my amendments. I think, as I mentioned, Senator Betzel would like with this amendment to suggest.
Senator Betzel,
Chair,
did you have?
The A-13 amendment.
Say, Mr. Chair,
Senator Neville,
can I just ask a question on that last amendment?
Sure.
I was trying to see where it fit in the bill, and so just so I understand, Senator Cohen, revenue has actually said they can raise another $41 million instead of 21.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, Department of Revenue has not explicitly said that, and we tried to get the message to them. I think. Mr. Gustafson out of finance, but there is a sense we can do something else with the compliance piece.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator, on what basis did you come up with the number of $41 million then, if revenue hasn't told you they can do that?
Well, we attempted to extrapolate from some of my discussions with counterparts in the House as to discussions they had. As well as some discussions we've had here.
So you did. You made your best guess. In other words,
I'm comfortable with it.
Okay, thank you.
But Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, there's a point of diminishing returns. I mean, what my bill coming in here said, we'll spend, and revenue said you can do this. Spend $10 million, you get 50. It doesn't mean you can spend $20 million and get, 100. It doesn't work that way. But there is another increment we might be able to go to, and I don't know exactly if this is the cutoff point, but I think we can do a little bit more. But at least they told the numbers we had, at least came in the bill in with, was ones that they said you definitely can book. So I think there's a little bit more to be done. So.
And Mr. Chairman, let me just respond to Senator Neville. You might recall the legislative auditor's report that talked about $1 billion in uncollected revenue, and that became an issue during the campaign. I don't dispute the auditor's report. I do dispute that you're not going to collect $1 billion. So we've tried to be careful, and you're not going to see amendment after amendment that says, okay, how about another $20 million? How about another $40 million? As Senator Betzel makes clear, there's a point of diminishing return. I'm not sure we're quite at that point, but we're at a point where I'm comfortable.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion on Senator Cohen's A?
We adopted that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, has the A-13 amendment been adopted?
Well, excuse me, we're on the Betz, Senator Betzel.
We have a handout.
Is the A-13 your amendment?
It's mine.
Okay. Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, members, I did know that there was going to be a little bit of extra revenue coming in, and I wanted to be consistent with the priorities expressed by the State Government Budget Division. Everybody wanted to do more, everybody wanted more money, but what this amendment does, and Mr. Lindeen go through it, there are some things that this covers and some things are just implied. I wanted to increase the amount of funding to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. They asked for $1 million. This will at least get them up a halfway point. The state auditor was required last year in the tax bill to do audits of Job Z. Now, I've notified Senator Bach and the tax committee that this is an issue that either it has to be funded or eliminated it, or eliminate the requirement. But right now the state auditor is required to do these audits. So with the additional funds here, I said, well, let's just put in this bill. I don't know what's going to happen in the tax committee. But if they eliminate it, we don't need these funds, or maybe part of it were needed because the requirement has already been there for the last year. But this was another eliminator funded. The Secretary of State, last year the legislature did require that there has to be some funding for domestic abuse programs through the Secretary of State's office. Again, we didn't fund it. Didn't fund it last year. It wasn't funded in this bill this year. It wasn't funded in the amendment that we adopted earlier. This now at least puts some money towards it. We had, when we were doing the budget balancing in my bill, the administration made it clear they wanted money for computer security to the tune of at least $17 million. This puts some more money back into computer security. This is one of the things that the governor felt strongly about. We put some more money back in. And then one of the things that was a big issue within the budget division, we just couldn't do it, but there's equipment grants and matching grants for AMPERS and public television to help finish that. That was a high priority, but there weren't any funds to do it. This just spends a little bit of the money that we just raised in this bill, I'd asked if we could have some consideration for this, and that's what the A13 amendment does. And I don't know if the council or
okay, that's on that sheet that you,
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lindeen may want to have some comments here. So.
I just wanted to point out one thing on there. One of the items listed is admin, restore the deputy commissioner. In the original bill, we had made that cut to their appropriation of $123,000 a year. But with the amendment that Senator Cohen offered, those savings are being captured within that amendment. So we will just basically restore this appropriation to the Department of Administration, and it'll be captured by the Commissioner of Finance in the number that was.
Further questions, Senator Stump?
That answered my question.
Okay. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment again. Senator Bessel and I have talked about this. So, in effect, we raise his target by this amount.
Okay. Any further discussion on Senator Betzel's A13 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further amendments on the bill?
I don't have anything further.
Any further amendments?
Is this sort of an addendum to the A13?
Any further amendments? Seeing none, Senator Betzel, did you have a motion to make?
I move that Senate File 1997, as amended, be recommended to pass.
On that Senator Betzel's motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Cohen.
And then we'll meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, and we've got Angie. Which bills do we have?
E-12 and economic development.
E-12 and economic development, we're told. So 8:30, Senator Cohen?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
The meeting is adjourned.